Just imagine a world where you will hold your entire future in the palm of your hand, when a tiny glowing crystal will guide you through an existence in which each day is more wonderful than the last, where it will be possible for you to obtain the fulfillment of every fantasy, the satisfaction of every vanity, the absolute attainment of every wish.
Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer presents the Saul David production of Logan's Run. A fantastic journey through a world beyond imagination. Welcome to the 23rd century. The perfect world of total pleasure. Imagine a world in which you need never be alone. You touch a switch, turn a dial, and the perfect lover steps into your arms. Every pleasure is yours to experience.
Runner!
There's just one catch. When the tiny crystal in the palm of your hand flashes its final message, your time is up. Michael York is Logan.
Run, Logan!
Policeman in a perfect world.
No!
Trained to track down runners.
Run, Logan!
Until he is forced to run himself.
Logan!
I'm your friend, I understand. We all go crazy once in a while. But she's a runner, and it's over.
Overwhelming, am I not?
Fox, an incredible being. More than human, more than machine. Diabolical guardian of the gateway to freedom. For Logan and the woman who loves him. MGM takes you into a new age of adventure in the first motion picture of the 23rd century. Logan's Run. It begins where imagination ends.
Hello.
Must find sanctuary.
Yes, welcome to the very last episode of Geek Brunch Retrocast.
Yes.
Our life clocks are blinking red. We are actually well overdue to be renewed.
We're way over 30.
We are way over the limit, and we've evaded the Sandmen until now, but they are closing in. It's only a matter of time before we are brought to the ceremony.
So we will broadcast as long as we possibly can and maybe find an old man with cats.
Hopefully. We're going to do our best to take down the system, but we're not sure.
And I'm not the one wearing the dress. That's Chris.
Yes, I'm the... I'm the sexy one. I did not know what to say there. I am Jenny Agutter.
God, she is sexy. Good Lord.
I did not, until a little bit before I watched Logan's Run, this is what we're talking about if you don't know. I didn't know that she was in it until a little bit before, because I know her from well, a few different things, but the first thing I knew her from was American Werewolf in London.
Oh, she was in that?
Yeah, she's like one of the main characters.
Oh.
It's
been ages since I've seen that movie, too. Like,
yeah.
It's been a long time. Like, I remember distinctive scenes, but, man, it's been a long time since I've seen that.
She plays the nurse that takes care of him.
Yeah.
And then ends up being his love interest in the film.
Yeah.
But...
I think it's what she was wearing in this thing. Like, she had that one outfit when she came out of that, like, what they have, like, dial a sex bot or
Yeah.
sex person. Like, if you're horny, and I guess when you're a sandman, you're kind of well to do in society. Like,
Yeah,
you can
get that
have any
impression.
women or have an orgy or whatever you want at any time because, you work hard 24/7 to make sure society keeps running. And I'm thinking the age thing is totally whoever invented it or invented the computer that monitors all this bullshit was doing it for a reason. In other words, Utopian City can only fit so many fucking people. So
Yeah.
we will always have a fixed amount of people, and when your time is up, you'll be replaced by another clone of yourself, and then the number gets incremented. So, like, if you're Logan 5, you're the next one in the chamber will be Logan 6. And when your light goes totally red and is not blinking, you're done. And then the Sandman come after you. You sacrifice yourself to. I don't exactly understand what that thing is. It's
Right.
like an energy source, but you get absorbed by it, and it's believed that you have life after that, at least amongst the masses. But there is a small percentage of the masses that think once you do that, you're dead. So that's why you have runners.
Yeah. Well, we really jumped into it.
Yeah. We had
Yeah,
an
that's
interesting
our.
discussion. Me and Barb did because Barb loves the movie too. Like she's seen it more than me. She knows every line by like way before it happens. Like she memorized it. I'm like, Barb, how did you watch this thing so many times? And we couldn't figure it out because either they played it over and over again on some channel and watched it over and over again, or she had it on tape or something.
Yeah,
But
maybe.
it was rated R and it did have nudity, which I didn't remember. I didn't
You know,
remember that part.
was it rated R though? Because I want to say it wasn't, and because I know sometimes back in the day, they didn't always give you an R rating for nudity, so if you had a little bit of nudity.
It had a lot, though. It had the sex room. I don't know.
I know it was kind of strange, although.
Even though they,
Oh, it was rated PG.
whoever directed the movie, wow, whoever directed the movie did a really good job of hiding, of like showing the nudity, but hiding a lot of the privates, whether it be a chunk of ice or something like that. There was
Right.
what there's one nude scene where they have to disrobe because they were in water and they end up in a freezing area, and
Right.
that does have full nudity. But they do a really good job, like in Buck Rogers, of the women wear these dresses, man. Holy shit. They are like cut like right above the, I mean, right below the crotch. Just they are so low cut. It's unbelievable. But we should I think we gave a good introduction of what this is. But it was a 1976 science fiction film directed by Michael Anderson, starring Michael York and Jerry Aguder, and had Richard Jordan and Farrah Fawcett.
Jenny.
Jenny. What did I
Yeah,
say? Joey?
Jerry.
And Farrah Fawcett, which I didn't remember until I got to the scene, and I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I
But
didn't know until she showed up on screen.
and the interesting thing is, this time she was married to Lee Majors because she was Farrah Fawcett Majors in the credits. But
Yeah, she doesn't have a big role, but she's so famous, it stands out that she's in the film.
yeah,
It's a pivotal scene,
it's a
but
pivotal scene in the movie, and
yeah.
if anybody else stands out, she probably stands out as like the fifth actress. or you know, I mean the fifth actor that's available. I mean, there's only a small amount of characters that are really introduced, and one of them's a robot.
Yeah, it's
So.
not a huge cast. There's a ton of extras. There's a number of scenes where there's a lot of people in the film, but there's not it's a small main cast. But yeah, one other thing that people might know Jenny Geter for. I mean, she's continued to, like, earlier on she was kind of a sex symbol,
And I
to
could
some
see why.
extent.
Good Lord.
Yeah, I mean, like, a lot of the almost all of her early films that she was in up to American Werewolf in London, she appeared naked at some point, but pretty much after that she continued to, that was kind of the end of it. You know, as she got older, she continued to act to this present day, and she's actually, you might not recognize her, but she, because I didn't at first, so she's actually in the Avengers and in the Winter Soldier as as one of the councilwomen, as
Council.
councilwoman,
Oh,
councilwoman
on the
Holly.
panels,
Yeah,
the
I mean, she's
Shield
more.
Councilwoman.
She just kind of shows up on the Security Council in the Avengers, but so she's more prominent in the Winter Soldier. She's like one of the council people that are with Robert Redford's character in that film. So she's more noticeable in the Winter Soldier. But yeah, she continues to act to this day. Same thing with the male lead.
Michael York.
Yeah, he's still around. Actually, as a
He
matter of fact, I more recognize him from his, like, picture of him as he's older. He's been in, like, the Austin Powers movies,
yeah.
most prominently, but he's been in a ton of different
Well,
stuff.
he was in another favorite movie of mine, which is the Three Musketeers, the Musketeer franchise, the Four Musketeers. That was actually films done by Salkind and the ones that did the Superman films, the Chris Reeves films.
Oh,
They
okay.
were the producers of it. They did Three Musketeers, the Four Musketeers, and they didn't do the follow-ups. There were a couple of other ones that came much later, and I think they were released direct to DVD, if I remember. But it still had it was the Return of the Musketeers. But they are some of my favorite movies, man. He played D'Artagnan, and I guess at this time he made like an impression. He was like my Harrison Ford in the 70s. So like if there was a Michael York film, I was like, God, he's Logan, he's D'Artagnan, you know. I was like, this guy's badass, you know.
Gotcha.
And I love Michael York. I think he's great. And I think he was
Cool.
a great like action star, at least from a kid's eyes. I thought a lot of him, so when I knew him, when I saw him on the screen, I like, oh, it's D'Artagnan. Oh, it's Logan. And
Yeah.
caused me to watch Logan's Run, which the TV show, which wasn't as good, but I
Which
think the guy's awesome.
I guess we should note that the TV show didn't star Michael York or Jenny Agutter.
Yeah, that was
They had different actors.
some curly-haired guy.
Yeah, I guess I have it right here. It was a guy named Gregory Harrison, and Jenny Agutter's character is played by a woman named Heather Menzies Urich. So
Yeah.
there you go.
We've kind of given a synopsis already, but you're in a just through our conversation, but you're in the city and you have this jewel that's in the palm of your hand, and it is chained as various colors, and when it starts flashing red, it just means you're getting close to the year that you have to sacrifice yourself. You have to be renewed by the carousel. This carousel is like this huge diamond in the center of the room, and people put on robes and they put on masks, and then they start floating to the center of the carousel, and you never really see what happens to them. They kind of like dissipate, like
Yeah, kind of
energy.
explode.
Yeah,
There's a little bit of an
they kind
explosion.
of float up and then pop, And you think they hit like some kind of energy field, or they're being reabsorbed by, I don't know, like energy can't be destroyed, you're recreated, you know?
Right. First law of thermodynamics.
Yeah.
But
So.
the crowd, it should be noted, is really fucking into it too. I
Yeah, it's like.
mean, it's like the Super Bowl, the people that
But
are watching.
there are some things. The one thing I noticed when watching it again, this is my third time watching it,
Okay.
and the first times when I was really young, and the second time was, I guess, in my 20s, and now I'm in, my 40s, and the thing I notice is that society appears, at least if you're in the main city, it appears to be fairly equal. Do you know what I mean? The technology and the, I don't know how you pay for things or whatever, but it seems like everybody has a job to do in that city, and there's no slum unless you start going into the outer layers of the city. Do you know, if you go underneath.
Yeah, they have an area where it turns out certain people are relegated, but for the most part, because they are controlling the population, you have some people dressed up in green, some people dressed up in red, and then you have the Sandmen who wear black, which Logan is and his friend Francis. But yeah, it does seem like pretty much people are equal for the most part.
And the other thing is the Sandman never seemed to report to like any leader other than the computer. Do you know what I mean? There was like no boss like of these Sandmen. They were all kind of at the same level, and they were like judges in Judge Dredd, and that, but Judge Dredd, you always saw who the bosses were in the films, and
Yeah, that's true.
they would sync up with this computer, and you don't understand totally what happens during this session because you see Francis do it, and then you see Logan do it for another reason, pretty much to ask questions. It's a bad thing to do. Is the worst thing you could do is ask questions in this society, because once you start asking questions, you are thought of as maybe like you're going to be a runner or something like this. Like you're questioning what we've done for years and years and years. And when he first meets the girl, he pretty much calls it up because he wants to get laid. He's like, I want to get some fucking on, right? And he dials this thing, and I guess you could pick men, women, whatever you want. And he picks this woman. She comes out and kind of like the dress that she's in the movie, except it's, oh my God, it's like a front and a back, and it has a slit down the side. Like there are no panties. You know
Well,
immediately.
it's see-through as
Yeah, it's
well.
like
It's somewhat
see-through.
see-through green. Well, I don't know if you can pick because he does dial up a guy first. So I
Yeah,
think you just
he
have to cycle
does.
through and he's like, no, because this guy.
Well, maybe he's like, I don't feel like that right now,
Yeah,
because.
maybe he changed his mind. It is the future, you know?
But he dials her up, and she asks a lot of questions, and she's there for seems like for another reason. Like she's there so she could take the Sandman and lead him to these other runners that will take him out, I think.
Yeah, because it tells you that they're through their conversation, you can understand that she's put herself like the people that he brings up that you bring up through the circuit. They put themselves there willingly, so these people want to just like have sex with Sandman, or I don't know if it's just the Sandman that use the system, but so she's put herself there. She's distraught because one of her friends was recently renewed. In the ceremony that we just saw at the beginning of the film, and she sees things differently. You know, she's willing. She's not willing. Like she's regretting putting herself on the circuit. She did it because she was distraught, and she's the first at this point in the film. It's the first character to introduce any sort of doubt or different feelings about their society.
Right. But she's
And
just.
Logan's not into it. He's just like grabs. He's like, "Let's have sex."
Yeah, let's have sex. And she doesn't. She's like, "I don't want to have sex. Then why'd you fucking, get into this machine so I could dial you up,
Yeah.
But she does ask a lot of questions that makes him start to think,
Yeah,
which he never thought about before.
she introduces those ideas
And
for the first time.
the other thing I want to mention is that I get the impression that there's like this really, really solid bond between Logan and Francis. Like, it's deeper than just coworkers. It is like a solid friendship. Like, these guys have been together for a long time, and when Logan starts to astray, Francis wants to slap him and say, "Hey, buddy, what's wrong?" It's like when something happens to your best friend and they start acting differently, Francis w and he becomes obsessed with this throughout the movie. Like, Francis's whole goal is to get Logan. But Logan eventually, there is a scene in there that really, really confused me. Like, when they start to escape, and he's like, "Okay, my," he goes to a machine and he has this Anka. How do you pronounce it?
Just ank
Ankh,
or onk
Ankh.
ank onk
Yeah, it's like that cross with the circle at the top.
Yeah,
Is
it's an
he, isn't it an
Egyptian.
Egyptian? Yeah, an Egyptian symbol.
Yeah.
And
Oh, they're coming to get you.
yeah, that's a Sandman.
It's the Sandman.
Sorry, we have to cut this episode. I gotta start running, and I'm pretty fat, so I gotta get a head start. But that Ankh raises even more questions in Logan's mind. So he does the stupidest thing he could possibly do. Well, I guess it's the best thing he could possibly do. It depends on how you look at it. But he goes to the computer, and then he's like, "Computer, what is the symbol?" And then he starts asking questions about sanctuary. And the computer has this awesome algorithm in it that's like, why is he asking these questions and all this stuff? It essentially ages him, and it turns his crystal to a flashing red, even though he's got more years left. And his whole job is to uncover this the runners or this guild that has access to sanctuary, and use that Ankh to a key to find sanctuary. So he's kind of like working undercover. And kind of not, because the girl is growing on him and he's seeing things for the first time that he never understood before. So.
Yeah, it's sort of a, I think the computer actually is the one that first introduces the term sanctuary. I wasn't sure if it was just if it was just a like a if he would normally go to the computer as part of his routine or not, but Jessica, and she's Jessica 6, I think. Like you were mentioning in the beginning of the episode, all the characters have a number after their name. Like Logan is number Logan 5, and Francis is Francis 7. I think she's Jessica 6.
Yeah, she's six.
Yeah, and she's actually wearing an Ankh. Around her neck, and you might think it's just a jewelry or some sort of futuristic affectation adoption of this ancient symbol. But yeah, the computer's asking him about the Ankh and what does he know about sanctuary, and he hasn't heard of it, and he's shocked to find out that as far as he knows, him and the other Sandmen, they do their job. They track down runners, which are, people who, when it's their time to go into the carousel, try to escape. They're not buying the whole thing. They want to continue to live. And this whole concept of the idea of there being a sanctuary, that there being a way out of the city, that's this like underground rumor. And he's pretty, you could tell for the first time that, now that he's actually confronted with losing his own life, he's not so happy-go-lucky as we see him earlier in the film with Francis, and they're just love and life. Now that he's lost those 4 years that he was just kind of keeping him relaxed because he wasn't facing the end yet, he starts freaking out a little bit, like, you're going to give me the 4 years back, right? I'm going to get the 4 years back. He repeats it several times and the computer never answers him. But he's not at this point totally willing to rebel, you know?
But later on in the film, he does something that I think is pretty questionable, because he kind of commits to this effort, but then right. He like notifies the Sandman that the location of all that, the rebellion, if you will.
Yeah.
So.
And I think at some point during the film, he makes a transition, but I thought that one of the things that made this film good is that they set it up this way so that as you watch the movie for a long time, it creates that suspension. You're not sure, is he just going along with this because he's following the orders, and is he ultimately going to betray Jenny and other people, or is he actually starting to want to rebel for real and run for real? So if you knew which one it was,
it wouldn't have been interesting,
as engaging. I mean, it'd still be decent, but it wouldn't be as good because you would kind of know what his deal was. So I thought that was really nice.
Yeah, what side is he going to flip on? Because at the time that he does do his mission, if you will, what's really another thing that's interesting thing about this mission is none of the other Sandmen know about it.
Right.
You know, like Francis isn't aware of it. The other Sandmen aren't aware of it. They legitimately think that Logan's a runner. Like he betrayed his own people.
Yep.
The computer doesn't notify anybody about it. It just you never know who the big boss is. And if the boss is a computer. And but it is really cool. So he gets to know Jenny and they go on this they start to run, and he's like, what's the first thing I need to do? I need to change the way I look, that's for sure. So he goes to this place for like a facelift. It's like this it's really like you could choose your own face. You could choose your own hair color. It looks like you could even choose your own body style. Mm-hmm. And they lead him there, and the woman knows that this place is at least linked somewhat to the rebellion, that it might be safe to do this.
Yeah, because before this happens, actually, he calls Jessica back to his apartment, and she says, you know, I'm still not, like, as far as she knows, she just thinks he wants to have sex with her again. He's like, she's like, why me of all the women in the city? You could have anybody you want. And they go, he tells her, you know, I know about Cathedral, or I know about Sanctuary. Take me there. Tell me what you know. I know you're connected. And she's denying things. But then we see her with some other people in the city, and they're telling her, you know, it's dangerous. If this Sandman knows about Sanctuary, you need to kill him. So then she meets up with them again, and she's, as far as we know, planning to like follow through with this. And he gets a call that there's a runner in Cathedral, and this is we find out that there's this place called Cathedral, which is a reservation for, they call it for violent delinquents. And they get surrounded there. And they've by like these thugs and stuff, but ultimately fight them off.
It's kind of like Lord of the Flies, because it seems like it's this place, Cathedral, is you can't be over 16 or something like that. I can't remember the age.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they're all young kids. And one of the first kids they run into is like a little girl who steals one of Jessica's bracelets. Mm-hmm. As they go through the cathedral. And then as they start, they see the runner, and he's like, runner! And you don't know what his intent is at this time, because you don't know if he's going to shoot her or if he's really going to try to help her. And I think this is when the tie changes a little bit, but it's not a full commitment. he goes after her, and then all these guys start swinging down, kind of like in Thunderdome, right? Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, there's a bunch of kids and stuff like that. All these kids start sliding down, they surround him. But they don't seem to have like electronic weapons or these guns or anything. They have like knives and spears and that kind of weapon. So they surround him, and it looks like he's going to be captured, but then he starts to do a psychological battle, like with this one guy. He pretty much says, "How old are you?" And he goes, like, 15. Well, he says, "16, what do you think these people are going to do to you when you turn 16?" And everybody starts looking at each other, and he starts to doubt what he's doing, and he's like, "Oh, let's surround him." But Logan pulls his gun out and starts shooting around. And the guns are kind of unique in itself. They're not like lasers like in Star Wars that you like see the, you hear the gunshot. There's a spark at the end of the gun, and then you see the destination at which it hits, and there's like a little bit of an explosion. But he doesn't kill anybody. He basically shoots around these kids, but they get scared. All of them go around except for this one kid who uses his knife and eventually gets scared off and runs away. And then they find the girl in the red dress who was the runner, and she's in a panic. She's like, "My light went off early." She's trying to make up some bullshit, and because she thinks he's a Sandman. "Don't kill me, don't kill me." And he at this point, Logan says, "I'm not going to kill you. I'm here to help you." And he basically doesn't he give her something at that time? He gives her like a pellet. It's called a gas pellet, I think. That will develop a smoke screen because he knows that, like, Frances, who's following him, she might run into him. And she's like, "Well, you can keep running, but you might need this pellet." What is very interesting is he doesn't tell her, "Join us, and we're runners too. You can follow us." He pretty much gives her this little Batman gas pellet. And meanwhile, Francis sees all of these things through like these th this like a fence. It's like a gated thing. And one of the first thing he does when they depart is he just yells "runner" and he shoots that girl, and you hear a huge scream. So Logan and Jessica know that that girl is probably dead, and they continue to run. But one of the other things they do run, like we talked about the face. He goes to get his face changed, and that doesn't work out so well. So, this is where Farrah Fawcett is, and the Barbara mentioned that the young guy that is running the machines and stuff and that thing kind of looked like a really young Paul Rudd, but he wasn't Paul Rudd, but. And he did, if you look at the close shots of him, but he was going to get his face changed. But I guess he gets the call from the. Meanwhile, there's some runners that are trying to jump Logan, right? There's those two guys in the red suits.
Well, what happens like before they get to the doctor, Jenny admits that she was supposed to kill Logan, so, 'cause she sees him let this runner go, and she finally believes him. And you still don't know, did he let this one runner go so that Jenny would trust him, and is he going to betray her? It's still kind of up in the air, but she seems to believe him at this point. And when they go to the doctor, you see, once Logan's on the operation table and stuff, you see Jenny talking to the doctor, and it lets you know that the doctor is involved with Jenny and these other people that are against the system. But since Jenny believes Logan at this point, she wants to help him, but the doctor gets a call, which I presume comes from like other members of their organization that says like, take this dude out.
I thought it was those two guys in the red outfits that were following him.
I think that they are all, I assume that they were all working together. Like the guys in the red outfits were like among the same people that Jenny was talking to earlier that told her to kill Logan. And I think the doctor is in with them as well.
Oh yeah, I think they're all
So.
together. And the original is like. The original belief is they can't turn a Sandman, so they'll kill the Sandman,
Yeah.
and they'll set him up. That was
Right.
the whole intent, is let's take Logan out.
Yeah.
But like you said, So he gets under this laser machine and it starts cutting into him. Like they immediately know something's wrong. And I think if it wasn't for Jessica, he might have got killed. Don't you agree?
Yeah, because he was pretty much trapped, and this machine, it can either change your face or it can change your body. And he says, just the face. And Holly Farrah Fawcett's character, she's like, "You should do dark hair. I really like dark hair." She just keeps saying, like, "Do dark hair, and tell him to give you dark hair." And so yeah, the doctor tries to kill him, and he's pretty much just trapped in this chair. So when Jenny realizes what's going on, she goes in and attacks the doctor to stop him because she believes. And this was like a really big chase scene ends up happening where Francis is still following them, and people that are on the resistance are chasing after Logan and Jenny, and they run through a bunch of different weird rooms and stuff
Yeah,
like.
well, I think Francis actually hits that one locale though too, where because the Logan gets in that fight with the doctor, he throws the doctor on the table and it cuts up the doc. It basically kills the doctor, and
Yeah, the
Farrah
doctor
Fawcett's the
gets killed.
witness, and Francis comes around that time, and then the big chase scene, just like you said. One of the interesting things is they go into the love shop,
Yeah.
which I guess is like. In this world, if you're in this one caste of society at this level in the city, you could just go in there. There doesn't seem to be any monetary payment. You just go in there and you pick men, women, and you just orgy. You just have sex,
Yeah, there's
and
naked people everywhere.
everywhere. And there's weird lights, and it seems like they were moving in slow motion, doesn't it?
It's super trippy. Like,
Yeah.
I was making sure like my carbon monoxide detector wasn't going off or something, because I was like, I thought maybe I was like tripping.
Yeah, you're like, what the hell? Why are things moving so
It's
slow?
like, am I breathing in like toxic chemicals or something? But yeah, it's super trippy. It's like, it's kind of spaced out, and it is. The only thing I can think, like, I mean, I still don't think that this would get a PG rating today, but part of the reason I think it did back in the day when they weren't is, I don't think, because there's no like cursing, there's very little like blood or violence. I mean, there's a couple scenes, but whenever there is nudity, it's always, like you said, obscured in some way, and like, but you definitely do see a lot of nudity. But this is like this scene, it's really
It's very
dark, and there's lots of
weird. There's like
flashing
red light.
colors.
It's dark. You see a lot of nakedness, but it's like arms and legs and
Everything happens kind
backside
of quick.
backs. But you don't see a lot of the privates. You see a little bit if you look really hard.
You see boobs and stuff here all over the
Yeah.
place, but it's all fast. Like, you see flashes of flesh here and there, and then they, like, at one point they go through this room, and they're like, these people, like, they just want more and more, because Logan and Jenny, they both get grabbed, and they're trying to just like pull them down into the sex pile and strip their clothes off and stuff, and they're trying to get through, and they go through this one room where like people are painted in like glow in the dark body paint.
Yeah.
Super crazy. This is like quite a place.
And that's where Francis, as he's following them, he eventually sees them in like the Star Wars trash compactor scene, but it's not. It's basically a room that looks like it's what do you of like a fishery or something? Like it's really weird. And there's a window behind it with all kinds of this water, and Francis kind of shoots the window, and all this water leaks in and kind of flushes Logan and Jessica out into this other area, and they're able to close the door behind them as the
Yeah.
water's filling in. But it's kind of like a trash compactor scene in Star Wars,
It
except
was
it's a
definitely
bunch of
similar,
water.
yeah. It's like,
Yeah.
let's find a way to get the lead actress wet.
And then what was really cool is they run into this rebellion, and the one thing I really liked about it is there's like one leader that's talking, but there's a lot of people there, and they never show anybody's faces. It's like obscured with darkness.
Yeah,
It's like
it's
they don't totally trust Logan, and it looks
No,
like
they
they might
definitely
even
don't.
they want to kill him, until the Farrah Fawcett comes back, and it's a weird Farrah Fawcett scene because it's like Jessica does a Jedi mind trick with her. Farrah Fawcett shows up and she's like, "Oh, this guy and this girl, they killed the doctor," and she's all panicking, and then Jessica does, "But we didn't kill the doctor, it was the other Sandman." And then she like questions and she says, "Oh, now I'm starting to remember."
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost as if she's kind of persuasive. Well, I guess she's really persuasive or something. Yeah. I don't know that it was really.
These are not the droids you're looking for. Yeah. Either that or she is trying to remember. But how would you forget something that traumatic? I mean, Logan did kill the doctor. He did throw the doctor on the table.
Yeah. I think it was just bad acting on Farrah Fawcett's part, to be honest. I think that's really what it came down to. It wasn't acted very well on her part, but
she's
convinced, because for a minute there you think they're totally fucked, because at the point that she shows up, it's the worst possible timing, because they're trying to convince these rebellion people that they're who are holding them at, well, I would say sword's length, but they're these weird sticks that they can shoot puffs of smoke out of, or chemical that seems to be like painful to them.
Yeah.
These weird weapons. Fortunately, Jenny's able to convince Holly that of what actually happened. And they're, I mean, Logan and Jenny, they're not even sure, like, is this Sanctuary, or do you know anything about Sanctuary? And it definitely is not. They say, you know, you have to keep going.
That's what's kind of cool, is you never know if they're getting to where they're going, because you don't know what they're going to. They don't know where they're going to.
Yeah.
So that's what's interesting. But they kind of – the leader says, okay, let them pass. And this is where Logan does the funky thing with his wrist watch or whatever it is, his – that's linked up to all the other Sandmen, is he basically activates it. And what it is it's a tracing signal. And all of these Sandman get to that location really fast and just start killing people left and right as Logan and Jessica are still running. So you're like, man, he betrayed all those guys that he just won the trust of.
Mm-hmm.
He just activated it so all the Sandman could get there. And then they managed to get away. And then they enter this cool scene, which I think is pretty awesome, is they're – they enter that box area, right? Which is like, Box is this robot,
mm-hmm.
and he's got like freeze rays and stuff, because they enter this area and it's like a refrigerator. It's like all iced over. It's like mm-hmm. It's like a freezer that you don't never defrost. It just ice everywhere. And they get there and they have to disrobe. Luckily, they find some old parkas there. I don't know why they're there.
Yeah, Logan says, let's take off our clothes first before they freeze on us.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting is they do take off all their clothes. So here's where you have a full, you know, naked scene with Jessica. And then Logan, yeah, he takes off his shirt. And then you say, well, he never took off his pants. And then the next scene they cut to, his pants are off, because you could see his feet and his legs. Mm. And they're kind of in these parkas and they're freezing, and they meet Box, and Box says, "Fish, plankton, fish from the sea," or I don't know what the
something
fuck
from,
it says.
Yeah, something from the sea. Keeps like repeating this weird line.
Yeah, and you learn that Box's whole purpose is to like feed. He like brings in food, I think, for the Dome City, essentially, like outside sources. And at least that was his purpose at one time. I don't know if he's active now, but he's a droid that's his whole purpose was to be like maintain the refrigerator, maintain the food, so people could then come and get the food later on.
Yeah.
And they walk into this one room, see all these humans, they're frozen, and that's when things are like, holy shit, this guy's gonna freeze us into ice pops. And Logan grabs his gun. He shoots Box, I think, twice in the midsection, but it doesn't seem to affect him too much, because like Box is like Mr. Freeze. He's got a gun on each side and he's ready to freeze them. But Logan luckily shoots one of the guns out of his hand and then shoots him in the midsection, so he has one gun, and then gets into this fight with him. But he manages to shoot the ceiling, which brings down the roof down on top of him.
Yeah.
And they kind of squeeze out of there. And once they squeeze out of there, they're out of the Dome City. Like, they get through the next threshold. They're, like, out. And the first thing they see is the sun, and they're like, what the hell is that?
Yeah, they've never seen the sun before. They're confused by it. It's the first time they've ever seen it. And, I think this is at what point we see that Francis is still following them. He's very determined. But then we just kind of go through this sequence that's pretty cool, where they come upon Washington D.C. We find out that that's where the Dome City is near, and everything's overgrown, like the Potomac, not the Potomac, but the whatever you, I forget what you call the body of water that leads up to the Washington Monument. That's why I said Potomac, because I started thinking of George Washington. But everything's overgrown. They go to the Lincoln Monument, and it's covered with vegetation.
Kind of like Planet of the Apes at that time.
Yeah. But they go up to the Lincoln Monument, the actual statue of Lincoln, and they're just really amazed by his face, they say that must be the look of being old, and you realize they've never seen anybody, they've never seen an old person, they've never seen anyone over the age of 30, because that's their society. It's all people that are in their 30, and or that are 30 or younger, and and they also come upon a cemetery, which is a really cool sequence where they've never seen gravestones. They don't bury their dead, so they don't understand the idea of burying someone, and they're reading the tombstone and just saying, there's names and dates. What do these dates mean? And what is a beloved husband? What is a beloved wife? You know, all these concepts are foreign to them. And I mean, if you thought about it, you'd realize, but this really drives home what their society is like.
Yeah.
That they don't know what all of these things are. And then we get the crazy cat man.
Yeah, and there's one interesting thing there is they actually spend the night, and they're going through, they have a good swim scene in the lake where it looks like they make love, and then
another opportunity to take off their clothes.
Another opportunity to take off their clothes and be naked, but there's a scene in there where Jessica just totally has a meltdown. She's like, I hate it outside. I hate the outside. It's awful out here. And there's like a gecko or a salamander or something there that crawls up her dress, and she's like, had it. I hate outside. It reminded me of Daryl Taylor. Like, because Daryl hates like camping and all that shit. He wants to live in a dome city. And I'm like, man, this whole Jessica reminds me of Daryl. Because she has a meltdown.
Yeah, only in that regard.
Yeah.
Doesn't really look like Daryl.
No, oh hell no. But but it is interesting how she just wanted to go back to her old life, and she did volunteer because her jewel wasn't flashing red.
Right.
She still had more years. Even at one point, Logan was like, "You could go back. I have to leave." You know.
But and it makes sense
too. She's still green. She had many, many years left, and she's no, I need to follow through with you. And they meet this old guy. They're fascinated by his beard. They're like, wow, this guy's got a beard. He's white hair. His wrinkles. They're like, can I touch you? Yeah, do those hurt? And she's like, can I touch you? And he's like, yeah, you bet you can. He's like all happy.
He's kind of giggling. And
yeah.
He's a really quirky dude. I thought it was really well acted. Just how this guy's kind of – he's by himself.
It is weird though, because you still have to ask, like, where did all the people go?
Right.
You know, there's still a lot of questions. Like, he's there with a bunch of cats, And they know that people can age, and you don't have to die at 30, so that mystery is solved. But you're like, why is this old guy here all by himself? Like, where is everybody else?
Yeah, and the
He does make it a fact that he had parents, and his par he was
Yep.
he came from his mother's stomach, and they wasn't raised in this like genetic bath or whatever you want to call it back in the other dome. People had sex and it caused babies, and
Yeah,
like
and
that concept didn't exist.
they're f pretty fascinated by that too, that that he was born nat by his natural birth and stuff, and he never this character never has a name. He's just old man in the credits, but he's played by Peter Ustinov, who's a pretty famous actor actually. Like he's known for Spartacus and Death on the Nile, Billy Budd. He's one of the voice actors in like Disney's Robin Hood. But he's like an Academy Award-winning actor. He was Batiatus in Spartacus.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, the like the 60s movie.
Oh, the original.
Yeah, the
Okay.
original. Yeah, 'cause he passed away in like 2004, it looks like, but he was in the Stanley Kubrick Kirk Douglas
Yeah, I know. I never saw
movie.
that movie. I've seen clips of it. I've never watched it from beginning to end.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I've seen most of it, but I think I've also seen it in pieces, like, 'cause it's usually on like in the holidays and stuff.
Yeah, like on TBS or TNT or something like that. But
But
yeah, that I always thought that part was weird. And then Francis catches up to them, and he immediately catches Jessica, and there's this big conversation. Francis isn't like you can't. He can't. Logan tries to reason with them and can't. He's
Right.
like, "Hey, look at your crystal." Because one of the things they're fascinated with this man is he doesn't even have a crystal.
And
So
theirs
they're
have
like,
gone white.
"Yeah,
Theirs
theirs
have.
have gone white. They've run the these must be like battery charged or energy charged or wireless or
I kind of
devices."
wondered, yeah, if they were like actually, if it shows that they're actually connected to the computer system and the distance from the city deactivated
I think so, because when they were
it.
out, I think it was still flashing, and but as they started going faster, like when they were in the water, they realized, wow, these crystals are now white. There's no
Yeah, the
charge
distance.
left. And the man is fascinated. The old man, he's like, "Where can I get one of these?"
Yeah, he wants a crystal.
He's
He
like, "I want one of these."
actually he wants to trade one of his cats for it.
Yeah, he's like, "You could take this cat, but what are you gonna give me?"
Yeah.
Jessica has some kind of bracelet or jewelry that she gives him. But there's a fight scene with Francis. He tries to convince. He's like, "Francis, look at your hand." And Francis is like, he wants to, at this point, he wants to kill Logan. God dang it, she's eating more rabbit poop. I can't get her to stop eating that shit. Harley's
That's
just out there eating rabbit poop.
a weird hobby she's picked up.
Yeah. Harley, stop eating that poop. Come in here. You have food over here. I don't know why she does that. That's supposed to be harmless unless they got some kind of disease or something, because it's all
Yeah.
fiber. But
If you had the choice, though, it's always good not to eat poop, I've found. If you have the choice.
yeah. If it's not a post-apocalyptic world and you have to eat poop,
Right.
yes, come in and eat your food. Wow, she prefers rabbit poop to her own food. What does that say?
Says maybe we should try it. Maybe she's like knows something we don't.
I think it's like an aphrodisiac or something. It's like, wow, this is awesome.
Why is she
She
trying? Is she
starts
like
to,
trying to hump stuff now?
I guess. I don't know what she's doing.
She come in the house and go after some blankets.
Makes her feel good. But I forgot what I was talking about. Oh, the fight scene.
Yeah.
And he ends up killing Francis, and then they decide, oh, we got to go back. And the girl's like, we can't go back. And Logan's like, we have to, you know, we have to let everybody know that there's life out here and that you can live past 30. So they go back and they decide to take the old man with them, which is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And
at first, I don't think they were going to, but then he's like, wait, what about me? Like, because these are the first people, you know, he's seen in a really long time, it seems. I mean, there's, because you get like little signs of what might have happened and like what life might have been like before. There's all these paintings that he has that are like lined, like stacked up against the wall. One of them is of Lincoln. They're like, hey, we just saw that dude in a statue. And but as soon as the old man asks to come along, Logan's like, oh yeah, that's a good idea, because we'll show you. You know, you'll be our proof that people can live a long time.
And they get there, and there's a scene in there where they're doing carousel again, and Logan and Jessica are like, stop! You don't know what you're doing, guys! Don't enter carousel! You can live past 30! There's no life after that! And they start screaming, and then the Sandman eventually get them. They capture them. And what do they do immediately is they put Logan back onto the computer.
Yeah,
the
people
computer
just
starts asking him questions.
The people just think that they're crazy. Like, they're screaming, and the people just look at them and think they're crazy and start laughing and just go about their life, you know?
Yeah. But they hook him up to the computer, and then Logan beats the computer, essentially. He's like, there is no sanctuary, you know? There is, I forget all the different things he says, but
yeah, he just keeps sort of,
he just keeps mumbling stuff.
He just kind of keeps repeating things that it doesn't want to hear, and eventually it seems like
Oh yeah, like, Barb says he keeps saying "old man."
Yeah, it's almost like
there is no sanctuary.
It's almost like he keeps putting in bad input. You know, it's like he keeps putting in, he keeps causing errors.
He puts it in like an infinite loop. Like the program doesn't know how to deal with that bad data. Whoever wrote that code, he put in a fork bomb, which is like an infinite loop, into the computer program, and it brings it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it actually is really like what's meant to be going on there, and that's a way of like of destroying the system, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And
overloaded it.
Yeah. So it's kind of neat, actually. So this causes downfall pretty much of the dome.
There's another shootout once he overrides the computer between Logan and a few Sandmen, and they escape again, and then take all these people outside the dome, and they see this old man.
Yeah, because they had to actually they get all the way up to the building, and the only way for them to go in is to jump in through this this water system, and they have to swim in through. And he's too old to and out of shape to follow at this point, so they tell him to wait. And it works out pretty good, because once the people start fleeing the building because it's exploding, this whole huge crowd comes up and runs into this old man standing there, and they're just as fascinated by him as Logan and Jenny were. Or Logan and Jessica were, you know, you see him walking up and touching his face and all that.
And that's kind of how it ends. So God knows what's going to happen after that.
Yeah, it's left.
Because I read a comic book recently that was very similar in vein to this. It was by Palmiotti and Gray. It was an adaptation of a novella that was released direct to digital. And it was very similar, because it has a very similar ending, in the fact that society was always running like this, and then they find a truth to why they could leave this, you know, this area, and then it changes the whole game plan, and then you don't know what happens after that.
Yeah, I wonder. So I kind of want to I kind of want to read the book that this was based on now. It came out in 1967. It's by two authors, William F. Nolan and George Clayton Johnson. Because there's actually two more novels.
Oh, after this?
Yeah, there's Logan's World and Logan's Search that came out actually after this film was made. Two more, or like more recently, I guess there was like an ebook novella called Logan's Return, or novelette or something like that. It looks like the next novel, Logan's World, says on Wikipedia at least that it deals with events, the survivors, and like trying to construct a new reality. So I don't know. I guess, I mean, they sort of, I think it's fine just to leave it where the film does,
You can find out more if you want to.
yeah, at least according to what the novel writers had, there's been talks of a remake, of course,
Yeah,
like anything
but it's
else.
it man, it's been in the like last 10 years they've been talking about it.
Yeah, it looks like they've been talking about it even back into the 90s, but more frequently in the last 10 years or so. There's like Bryan Singer was involved at one point, and then they've hired different screenwriters, they're at one point Ryan Gosling and Rose Byrne were attached to a remake of it, and then Gosling was no longer involved. But the most recent thing they have here is that last year they had a new person involved in maybe writing a screenplay, so may happen eventually.
So this was released in 1976 for a budget of $9 million, and it made $25 million. It was nominated for a couple of Academy Awards for visual effects, and it didn't win, but it won six Saturn Awards, which I'd never heard about, for best science fiction film. Some other interesting things is Ebert of Siskel and Ebert fame gave it a 3-star rating, and he called it a vast, silly extravaganza. It was a cross between Arthur C. Clarke's The City of Stars and Planet of the Apes, but he said it had a lot of fun, but the New York Times review was a lot less positive. What did you think? Did you like it? You seem to have liked it.
Yeah, I dug it. I mean, it's dated in its special effects, but I'm very forgiving of that. I don't have any problem with that. I like watching, and sometimes I think my favorite, like, I love movies from the 70s and the 80s, yeah, I mean, I thought it was pretty well acted for the most part. I did, at first, the second half of the film, it seemed a little like, I felt a little underwhelmed in terms of the whole, like, there's such talk about sanctuary, and then it turns out to not really exist, and they just run into this old guy with a bunch of cats. But it didn't bother me for long, because I realized, like, this is exactly what Logan and Jenny are feeling, they were looking for this thing that they thought they had these expectations, and they're not really met, but they're fascinated by what they see. And
Because
it was,
it changes everything that you believed before.
yeah, so I realized that it actually did a good job of bringing me into that experience as a viewer. And the stuff with the Washington DC was cool, and I wasn't necessarily expecting to see like signs of our world when they got out. You didn't really know if what you would see, if it would just be kind of nondescript ruins or whatever. So it was kind of cool to have those like prominent monuments and stuff. But yeah, I dug it. Because I like sci-fi and I like older sci-fi movies and stuff. I think it makes a nice companion piece to Buck Rogers, actually, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it does.
You know, it sort of fits in.
Yeah, I think a lot of people like it if they like Planet of the Apes or Buck Rogers or
any of that
70s type sci-fi stuff, and you go in with the expectation that, yeah, it's a little dated in special effects and stuff, but the acting is solid and the story is good. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
and there's some cool, there's definitely some cool concepts in there, like the sex shop and some cool sci-fi stuff going on there.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a very colorful world too. Like they have some pan outs where you see the world and you could see like their transports moving between buildings and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had some exterior shots where they used, I guess, probably like matte paintings or something like that. But it was kind of interesting, like very futuristic and interesting looking, because I think it takes place, what, like in 2300s or something like that?
Yeah, this
2400s, almost same, like
2274.
Oh, okay. So I was a little far.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was cool. I'm glad. I don't know if I would have ever gotten around to watching it, so I'm glad that you wanted to cover it.
Yeah, and our next one will be Taxi Driver,
which doesn't really kind of fit the sci-fi.
Doesn't fit theme. The sci-fi, but it does fit the retro, it does fit the pop culture. It's a huge pop culture film.
Yeah, and it's 70s
with Robert De Niro.
Also,
yeah.
But so yeah, maybe. So if you're able to get it, maybe we'll cover that next time. If not, mm-hmm. sometime soon.
Yeah, I should be able to get it.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Cool. And that other book I was talking about that was similar in the vein of you live in this weird society and trying to break out is what is it called? U. Woolley's Wool. It was a 6-issue comic book from Cryptozoic. Hmm. And said they were living in like these missile silos and stuff. So they realized that there were areas outside that you could escape. They'd always get into these suits, and there was a controversy where they were making the suits so flimsy that they could never live out there and all the people would die. So that's how they would punish people. They'd say, oh, if you can walk out there, kind of like in the Egyptian times, sometimes they would torture people. Like I think they might have even done this to Moses, is they just let him walk. And they're like, if you could survive out there in the desert with nothing, then you get to live, but you'll probably die of starvation or dehydration. And
yeah, like I think there was a form of punishment of being exiled.
Yeah, that's
so you're not actually
exiled.
put directly to death.
They would do that in Judge Dredd too. Is they'd put somebody I forget what they'd call it, but you'd have to leave like Mega City 1 and go out into the God, I can't remember the zone they called it, but that's how you were exiled. You would have to leave, and that's kind of so. If you want to seek that out, if you like Logan's Run, I'd highly recommend it. If you want comic books, if you want novels, they're based on actual novels that you could find on like Amazon Digital. So
that's cool. Yeah, I gotta what I need to check out at some point is Judge Dredd stuff. I have a basic understanding of what like the you know story the world is about, but
mm-hmm.
I haven't seen either of the movies. I haven't ever read any Judge Dredd comics or anything. Just never gotten around to it. I really want to see the recent film. That's probably the first thing I'll do. But
yeah, and then you can watch the Schwarzenegger type. The yeah. one thing in the Stallone,
yeah.
In the Stallone thing, it's not that bad. Although he has got a campy sidekick, and he doesn't wear it's not traditional to the comic book, but it still is a decent sci-fi. And they do have one of the key characters in Judge Dredd that's a villain is like Mean Machine, or I think his name is Mean Machine, but he basically has this dial on his head, and he could turn that dial to get like angrier and angrier. And they do have a scene in there. God, I can't even remember what the Baron part is where they exile you to. It's frustrating me because it's got a cool name.
I mean, I'm pretty forgiving of. I always have a soft spot for Stallone, as I watched a ton of Stallone movies back in the day when I was growing up, and I think like one of the first movies, like really good movies that I saw when I was a kid was Rocky. As I remember, my aunt and uncle rented it, and we watched it at their house, and I just thought it was like one of the best movies ever when I as a kid. I still
Yeah,
think it's a really great movie, but so I always kind of like have.
I still love all the movies and all the trilogies. Like I'll rewatch them, like Rocky One, Rocky Two, Rocky Three, Rocky Four, Rocky Five was kind of weird, but I still enjoy any of them. I'll
I still
watch them
haven't
all.
seen the newer ones. I've seen 1 through 4. I never saw the other ones.
Yeah, you could kind
But
of stop there, but. There's some interesting stuff on the other one. One involves a young guy
yeah.
that he's mentoring, and then I can't remember what the last one was.
I think wasn't the last one like where he actually fights again or something.
Yeah, he comes back to fight. I just can't remember it that well. It was a good movie.
Yeah, it seems like that
Liking it.
one,
It
like
just
six.
less memorable because usually you can. Oh, you had Apollo Creed in the first two, you had Mr. T in the third one, and then the Russian guy in the fourth one.
Yeah, I remember kind of, Rocky V got mixed reviews, but it seemed like people dug the last one a little bit
Yeah.
better. But
Which I think was just called Rocky. I think it was just.
yeah, I don't think it was Rocky Six.
No, yeah, it didn't have a number, it was just Rocky.
So
Da, 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 da. All right. Well, that leads us into we have a few questions.
yeah, some good questions that I don't know how well I'm going to be able to answer.
I wouldn't post so much shit, I'd be able to find it easy. I try to
I
flag
think there were two
that
places
type
too. I
of
think I could probably find them pretty easily in my
I
notifications
found
here.
it.
I got it, okay.
First question was from Donnie Salvo. He says, have either of you ever read the Invader series from the 70s or the All-Star Squadron from the 80s? That's the first part of the question. And then there's some extra stuff here. It says, there's something about superheroes punching Nazis that I could read all day. I just like the World War II era. I buy a lot of the old DC war comics whenever I find them. Is there a specific time period you like in your comics set in? So the first question is, have you read any Invaders or All-Star Squadron? I know you even covered one of the All-Star Squadrons in here, right? I can't remember
Yeah, I think
All-Star Squadron or Infinity Inc. It was All-Star Squadron, right?
I talked briefly about because I covered the issue that had the All-Star Squadron 16-page preview in it. So I think I talked about that. I just kind of went over it sort of briefly, but yeah, I actually just a few weeks ago finally got the last issue that I needed to complete my run of All-Star Squadron. So I've read a good handful of the early part of the series, and then I was kind of waiting, even though the issue I needed was toward the end. I was kind of waiting to pick that up to pick it back up again. So, but yeah, I haven't read a lot of Invaders, but I did start reading All Star Squadron. I'm going to continue that because I really became a fan of those characters with the JSA series. In the last decade or whatever it was, and got real interested in the Justice Society and the history of that team and different appearances, and that's what made me want to go back and collect the All-Star Squadron series.
Yeah, I had bought most of it off the shelves and I have a full run of it. I've read probably 90% of it and just recently bought maybe like 5, 6 issues that I was missing, that I didn't read, and I'll probably cover in a future show. But yeah, I like World War II stuff. I like World War II, World War, you know, the that stuff more though, like in terms of non-hero. Like, I like it when it's like Sergeant Rock or Unknown Soldier or GI Combat.
Mm-hmm.
Or Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos. I like that stuff more than I do like having my heroes go against, because Hitler always had the Spear of Destiny, which would negate most of the heroes, because that was how they explained why the superheroes with all these amazing powers couldn't just go over to Germany and take out Hitler.
Right.
So you could have like your Batman, your, you know, the characters that don't have powers go over there, or that are technology based, but you can't have your super powered one, because this mystical thing would negate their powers. But
yeah,
I really like that stuff. And, I hope to revisit at some point. It would be nice if they did what they did with like Infinity Inc. and Secret Society of Supervillains, and just republished a hardcover of maybe the first 10 issues of it and see how it did, or they showcase it. I don't think that is showcased.
I believe there's at least one volume of it, in showcase.
Really?
I don't know if it's currently in print, but.
Huh. I didn't know that.
I think so, but I didn't really, for the most part, I didn't really have any trouble tracking down.
Oh, they're easy to find. I mean, the harder ones are probably like the Crisis tie-ins and stuff like that. But
those are, because
there was more demand for them.
Those are, because that was toward the end of the series, almost all, ironically, because All-Star Squadron of the comics that DC was publishing pre-Crisis was one of the most hugely affected by Crisis. So it was kind of ironic that it was one that tied most heavily into it toward the end.
Yeah.
But
So the second part of that question is, do you prefer any specific time period in your comics?
You know, I don't know if I do necessarily. I mean, I do like when comics are set in other periods, just to sort of change things up. I think sometimes it's more of a genre thing to me. Like, I do kind of like when stuff takes place in the, maybe like in the earlier part of the 20th century, but a lot of times that's when it's like a crime noir setting.
Yeah. And I like that. I like that, crime noir pulp characters.
Yeah.
You know, that in that time period.
So it's kind of a combination.
Those are quite enjoyable. And with Dynamite, you're kind of hit and miss in time period. Like, sometimes they'll take the pulp character and put them in current time. And then they'll have like a Shadow Year One, which is like an older one that's more pulpy in the time period that it's in. I prefer the older period where they have the old cars and stuff. Like right now I'm reading Shaft, and that is interesting. But I don't have any specific period. I like every period, but I like to change it up. I don't like to read the same current time all the time. I like to see stuff in the 20s and the 40s and, you know, the 50s, and I like the different time periods, and I like exploring the different time periods. I love that. Like, it might not be like a comic that came out in the 50s is much different than a comic that came out in the 60s and then the 70s. They're all distinctively different, and they all had different target audiences.
Yeah. But yeah, I do like, as much as I like going back and actually reading comics from like the 70s or the 80s or something, I do like when modern comics are set in older periods. So you have like modern writing and art sensibility combined with a different time period. It's nice to have
Yeah,
that.
and you could sometimes see those like in the Elseworlds and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they'll throw Batman in the 40s or
Right.
even earlier in the 1800s. And then you got the Western comics. Those are always fun when they do like Jonah Hex or any of those characters.
Yeah, like I like Justice League New Frontier a lot. Putting the like Justice League in the 50s. So yeah. I think
That takes us through that question. The other one is from Kyle Pettit, and this is more of a current question. He's just asking if we're reading Justice League 3000 because he's enjoying it. It's one of the fun books he likes on the shelves.
that's not a retro books I refuse to answer, Kyle. Just kidding. Thank you for listening. I read the first couple issues of it, but no, I haven't kept up with it. I did see it did seem interesting to me, some of the like I saw something about them having Booster Gold and Blue Beetle in it and stuff, and that
Yeah,
seemed
that issue
interesting.
just came out this week. It's got Blue Beetle and Booster on the cover.
Yeah, I saw that. That caught my interest, but no, I haven't been keeping up with that one.
I am keeping up with it because I buy all the DCs, but I'm not up to date on it. I've been on the, I just got up to date on Swamp Thing, which is like phenomenal. God, it's good. Holy crap. Especially if you read all of it in one sitting. It's so good.
Yeah, I'm not up to date on that, but Charles Soule is
Charles Soule, like what he did.
it's a really
Oh
cool.
God, he created a, you know, you had the green, the rot, and the red. Well, now there's the gray, which is like fungus and like funguses and all this weird shit. And
Yeah.
then you also have the metal, which is like fascinating because it's like as we move forward in years, technology starts to take over, and it's like a fascinating aspect how it could become one of these things and have its own avatar, and what they actually turn into the avatar is even more amazing because he created he got rid of the Parliament of Trees. He had these characters, Wolf and the Lady of the Weeds, who's absolutely like totally creepy.
Yeah.
He's done a fantastic job, and I know he's leaving the book soon, but so far, up to the current solicits, he's still doing it. So I'm really happy with that run. But there's a lot of runs that I'm just enjoying, like Aquaman and the others. I absolutely love it, and the reason I love it is really weird. Is it's like hitting a vibe with me, like it's old Batman and the Outsiders, because a lot of the Outsiders you'd never, you know, these characters were kind of not in their own books and you wouldn't see them. Well, these others are like that, and they have a weird dynamic just like the Outsiders did. And I'm enjoying the hell out of that one too. But that's current stuff. I do have Justice League 3000. I plan on getting caught up maybe during the holidays when I have some extra time. I'll read them.
Cool.
Brian Reigate from Comics and History says, "Are there any comics, TV, movie franchises that you feel should be kept in their original time period and not updated for modern times?"
That's a really good question. But
That's a
don't
whole
know.
episode right there.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time, like I would have to. I tried to start thinking about it, and I feel like that's a question that could be put to a lot of thought, and kind of have to go through a lot of different franchises in my mind, and sort of decide how I feel about the idea of them being updated. I mean.
I would like to see a Logan's Run update, but I don't know if his.
No, I think he's saying like All-Star Squadron, for example, like do you think
Captain
that that should just be
that
left in
area.
the, you know, but I don't really, 'cause I mean in that case I think like, you know, the JSA works well in the modern era, I think. So I don't think that that really would be one for me. So it would be franchises that take place in the past. You know, and so I don't know, like you were just talking about like the Dynamite line. I mean, do you think that the, I kind of think a lot of times that the, I sort of prefer the pulp characters
In the
if
40s.
they, yeah, if they stay when they, 'cause I, there's just something about like you almost kind of see it with Batman, how keeping Batman in the present day, they just have to keep updating and increasing the amount of technology that he has access to.
I'll give you an example where I preferred that, but the $6 million man, there was the $6 million man, Kevin Smith, which modernized it, and then there was the $6 million man season 5 or season 6, I can't remember what the heck it was. And if I put them side by side, even though I enjoyed both, I much prefer the season 6, where I'm back in the 70s, early 80s. Do you know what I mean? Because you do get a sense of time, and you do get a sense of things were offices look different. Computers were much different at that time, and it gave it a sense of that a $6 million man is more of a big deal than it would be in today's world. Do you know what I mean? To have those bionics. But I originally felt that with the pulp characters, but I think Dynamite has won me over with a lot of their current incarnations. So I was abrasive at first, but as I got into the modern storytelling of them being in current time, I enjoyed them so much that I felt differently.
Well, that's cool. I mean, I think that there's kind of, I'm not against updating them, but I do think that there's kind of something kind of cool seeing them, like you said, with the old cars and the old technology, seeing them fight crime with only access to the technology that they had at that time. It's kind of entertaining. Or just seeing like spy stories where they use the old technology. Like I know you don't you I don't you don't watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But there's a character on there now that his grandfather was in the Howling Commandos, and they have this mission where they need to, they don't have access to really like any tech, so he borrows his grandfather's old equipment case, and it's all this like technology that still works but is like from the 50s, and I don't know, it was just kind of fun. And so sometimes seeing like seeing a situation where the characters have to deal with are limited from our perspective can be intriguing sometimes. But yeah, I feel like that's probably something we could come back to, that question. I feel like that's one you could think about for a while. If we think, if we
As you start
thought, if I,
looking at various properties,
yeah, I think if I thought about it for a while, I could probably come up with some more that work better.
I'm an
But
easy
that,
sell though. They can move things as long as it's done well. I don't really care.
Yeah, me too, kind of. I'm just like, if you tell a good story,
There's some
do what you want.
aspects like you just said that won't hit you as hard. Like the $6 million man, his bionics were much more bigger deal in the 70s than they are now. So,
Yeah,
well,
sometimes that might be as far as I'll go. Like, I might prefer one or the other, but I'm not going to be like, I'm not going to shit on like the update.
there
So,
are shitty updates. I can't think of one offhand, but I'm pretty sure if I thought about it, I Catwoman, the movie, I really that was like an update of the whole character, with Halle Berry, and I didn't like that one. I'll rewatch it at some point, but I didn't like that take on her. It's a little bit different because it's not like a time period thing. It's a reimagining of a character that loses some of its inherent qualities, but it's kind of related to the question.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times it's like the update might be bad just because they didn't do a good job, but it might not because it's inherently not something that shouldn't be updated to a modern time period, you know?
Yeah.
They might have just done a bad job at it. So.
We have one last question, and it's best Suicide Squad team.
From Ken Jr.
Yeah, Vicious Smith.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not reading the current one. And I haven't really read much of the New 52 one. I mean, so I think I'm kind of like biased to the classic.
I'm a totally agree. My favorite will always be when they had Bronze Tiger, Captain Boomerang, Deadshot, Enchantress, Rick Flag, Nightshade, that group.
Yeah,
My
I mean,
favorite, the original group. But
I like
you
obscure characters,
I
so
also like when they take the original group and you only have like four core members, and then you add more members and they're kind of like the red shirts. Because that's what the Suicide Squad is. I mean, in order to be successful and to be called the Suicide Squad, you have to be able to lose members.
Yeah, that's kind of where I fall on that. I mean, I like the concept. I thought it was cool when they brought it into Arrow. And it's still a concept that exists in Arrow.
I do since we're in the Suicide Squad, but kind of related to Brian's question, I do prefer fat Amanda Waller and her characterization to these skinny ones, and I don't know why it is in my head, but I found when she was bigger that she had that like iron fist that I really believed, like the iron fist of like, I'm not scared of you, Batman, you ain't horse shit. Like I don't know, the physical appearance of her and the way they characterized her, with her personality, it seems to in my mind matter that she was a bigger woman. I don't know. But
Yeah, I don't know if it's just a like a preference based on what we're used to, but I kind of feel the same way and can't really call her the wall, you know, anymore.
yeah, you can't. But
But
that's the last of our questions. Keep them coming. And you can send them at any time, and we'll just save them for episodes. So,
yeah, good questions. We got some good
yeah.
questions for sure.
Thank you. It's good to always have, a handful of questions that we could answer it before we get to our comic books or movies. So, do you want to tackle your first comic?
Sure. I was looking at what some of the stuff was that I have covered in the past. I have a sometimes end up not following up with, just even with my own personal reading. So I went back and I read another issue of Tomb of Dracula, number three this time, because I talked about both number one and number two on different episodes of the show and really liked them, and it continues to be a case here. I mean, just really pretty impressed with this series. This is still when Archie Goodwin was writing it, and I know it continues to be good when Marv Wolfman comes on. But it has Gene Colan art with Tom Palmer inks once more. It's called Who Stalks the Vampire. And
you're reading this digitally, right?
Yeah, Marvel Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
So we had Frank Drake, who in the previous two stories, he inherited Dracula's castle, and his buddy ended up bringing Dracula back to life, and his girlfriend got turned into a vampire and he killed her. So when we meet up with him at the beginning of this issue, he's about to commit suicide. He's about to jump off a bridge in London. And he actually jumps, the only reason he doesn't die is he's caught by the last minute by the by a man named Taj, who works with this woman that's wearing a green cloak. So they rescue him, and she turns out she removes her cloak and or the hood of her cloak, and she turns out to be very beautiful Rachel Van Helsing. So they bring him in to their vehicle and begin to discuss how they found him. She saw a news article about his inheritance of the castle, and she just pretty much assumed a news item that he inherited the castle and then ended up selling it. So she pretty much just assumed that there was no good that would come of that situation. And that's when she started to try to track him down. Meanwhile, his Frank's friend Cliff, he's also been extremely affected by the events of the first two issues. He's at a pub where he's been all day long and doesn't want to leave because he's afraid of the night. Justifiably so, it turns out, because the owner of the pub throws him out, and not long after he's thrown out, Dracula shows up, and at this point he pretty much makes Cliff his slave. I mean, Dracula stories, he always has a human agent that can do stuff for him that he can't do himself, that can, you know, operate and protect him during the day. Way of him kind of combating that weakness that he has, and that's what he does with Cliff Graves. So Cliff goes and goes to retrieve Dracula's coffin. Meanwhile, Van Helsing, Rachel Van Helsing, and Taj and Frank, they get back to sort of the headquarters they're stationed at, and they're filling in, they're filling Frank in on their situation and showing him their weapons and how they battle vampires and all this. And Rachel, we find out that, as Frank is told, that Taj, he's a real big intimidating guy, Indian man, and the reason that he actually doesn't speak, because when he was a child, his entire village was killed by vampires, and so that's why he's dedicated himself, but he's never spoken since that happened. And so they're interesting characters. They're kind of making the point that, look, like, Frank, you can kill yourself, or you can like live a life of resentment, or you can be like us. We've experienced tragedy ourselves. Don't assume that we haven't. It's just we've dedicated ourselves. We've used that anger, that tragedy that we've experienced, to fuel our fight against Dracula and other vampires. And so they convince Frank to join up with them. So their next step is to... they know that Dracula is after this coffin, and they know that Dracula actually has coffins stashed all over the place that he can rest in. And so they know something must be special about this particular coffin, and they don't know what. Well, it turns out that this coffin is got a false bottom, and it's full of that's where Dracula's been hiding his wealth. It's full of gold coins. So this is where Cliff has gone to retrieve this for Dracula, and he's helped out by this night porter. It's because it's stashed in this basement of this hotel where Frank was staying. So at night turns to night while this is going on, and Dracula appears, and the porter is trying to get his hand on the gold. So Dracula ends up attacking him and killing him. So by the time Frank and Rachel and Taj show up at the same place, they open up the coffin, and it's just the night porter's corpse. But they were almost in time because Dracula and Cliff are nearby. They're just they set up this distraction. They've packed the gold into bags and are trying to sort of just disappear out the back. But one of the bags that they put the gold in breaks open and alerts the others to their presence, and a little bit of a fight ensues. But Dracula gets away. Rachel tries to shoot him with a crossbow, and he turns into a bat to avoid the bolt. And they get out, and they end up trapping the three good guys in the basement. By the time that they're able to get out, like Taj is super strong. He's not as strong as Dracula is because his strength is supernatural, but for a human being, he's extremely strong. He's able to eventually break down the door, but by the time they break down the door, the Scotland Yard has arrived, and they're down in this basement where there's been tons of strange noises, and there's a dead corpse. Well, I guess it's the only kind of corpse there with them. So they're immediately accused and taken back to Scotland Yard. So they're kind of delayed by this for a little while. And while they're delayed, Cliff is driving Dracula, and the Dracula's in the back of this truck, and Cliff drives him to this place where.
So he's like his Renfield, Cliff.
Exactly. Renfield is like the classic slave. Yeah, so he's pretty much made Cliff his
So,
Renfield.
does Cliff, what does he look like? Is he a good-looking chap, or is he like Renfield, who was always a weird, bug-eating,
No, he's not,
crotchety guy?
he's more of a normal dude. I mean, like, he was
Like you would, if you
Frank's
saw him on the
buddy.
street, you would not think anything of him, huh?
Yeah, except for like at this point, based on the events that have happened, and he hasn't really cleaned himself up since Dracula's taken him over. He's sort of let himself go a little bit. I mean, his like eyes are bloodshot, and he's unshaven
Oh,
and
so he
whatnot.
looks
But
like a vagrant or street, like
a little bit, yeah,
he
a
might
little bit.
smell,
He's
he might have some BO.
probably a little stinky. But because he was kind of the one that initially encouraged Frank to pursue this whole deal, and he's the one that pulled the stake out of Dracula's corpse to awake him in the first couple issues. Clifton was. So it's an interesting fate. I mean, one of the things I've said about this comic so far is with the first two issues is that the plot moves really fast, and that continues in this case. I mean, when issue one started, you had basically Frank Clifton and like Frank's girlfriend that Clifton also had feelings for, and 3 issues in, Frank has joined up with Van Helsing. Cliff is Dracula's slave, and I think her name was Julie or something like that, but she's been turned into a vampire and killed. So, it's the plot really keeps flowing. So the last couple of things that happen here are back at Scotland Yard, they're finally able, like, they pretty much just stick to their story, and the investigators are getting frustrated because they're just talking this vampire nonsense. Well, they have in the same building as the morgue, and they have the body of the night porter, and the night porter comes back to life. And so they fight him off and quickly kill him. But the investigators, Scotland Yard, sees all this and are quickly convinced that, amazingly, that they were telling the truth. And then the last thing that happens with Cliff and Dracula is that they pull up to this house where it's the person who bought Dracula's castle from Frank. And it's a woman named Strangeway. Her last name is Ilsa Strangeway. And Frank, or excuse me, Cliff goes in her, or rather, okay. I got this. It's a guy named Mr. Langston. He's like her solicitor. So he's got an appointment with her, and her butler's taking him in, and he's walking past these pictures of her. It's like, it's so dark in here. These pictures of her, she's a beautiful woman. No wonder everyone wanted her to be a model. And you can't even hardly see them with the way that she keeps the dark in here. But the closer they get to where she's located in the building, this large mansion, it gets more and more, the decor becomes more and more creepy, and like there's all these occult items. And he's like, well, I guess there's some positives to the dark lighting, because I can't see all this weird shit that well. So when he finally comes to the room, her study where she's at, she's got a copy of Dracula, the book by Bram Stoker. And she's just surrounded by all these weird occult items and stuff. And her solicitor is trying to convince her, you know, you shouldn't be wasting, like, I was a friend of your late husband. And I'm trying to do you favors here and help you look after your money, but you're wasting it all on, you're squandering your fortune, all this occult junk. And this is the last straw. You're buying this worthless castle. She pretty much dismisses him. She says, I was a model back in the day. I had the beauty like mine shouldn't age. She's an old woman now. And I've tried to resurrect my beauty with all these cult items, and none of them have worked. And this is my last shot. I believe, you know, she believes in the whole Dracula myth and stuff, and he's like, you're crazy. So she dismisses him. Well, she's not so crazy after all, because at the end of the issue, Dracula shows up, and she's like, yes, it's true after all. And she says, the lore is true. A vampire may not enter a home unless he's been invited. Very well, enter, Count Dracula. I believe there is much we can offer one another. Much indeed. So she bought the castle in hopes that it would draw out Dracula. Presumably she wants to be turned so that she can have her beauty back. So yeah, very, very cool issue.
Sorry, I coughed there.
Oh, that's okay.
I very cool. The mute button, but it was... It happened too fast. I still haven't gotten over that cold, man. I mean, I'm over it, but I can't get rid of the cough. It's weird.
Yeah, Kara was sick, and she's been feeling better, but she still has her cough, too.
Yeah.
It lingers for a while, it seems. It's, like, deep.
So I try to hit the mute button. Hopefully, I didn't cough too much, and this. I'm trying to hit the mute button, but sometimes it's hard for me to hear because the tones are very similar. Because it's a digital muter than a physical one.
Hmm. Gotcha. So yeah, I'm digging Tomb of Dracula. I want to try to remember to like actually read some more issues of it before a bunch of time goes by.
Yeah. That I do have in the omnibuses, but I don't have the original issues.
Hmm. That's cool.
Yeah, the first omnibus and the second omnibus, I think, are the comics. The third omnibus is the magazine. Sounds really cool. Sounds like it's one of those ones where you could easily get sucked in and read like five or six if you
Yeah,
got.
definitely.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to talk about one that's pretty large, but I'm just going to hit the high points. It's called World's Finest Comics, number 248, from, let me see what year this is from. 1977/78, and it was bi-monthly. I was a huge fan of these comics back in the day. They basically said dollar comics, and they had like all kinds of stories in them at the time. Adventure Comics did this, Superman Family did it, Batman Family, World's Finest, and there may be another one. But it was 80-page giants that were phenomenal as a kid, because you'd spend a buck instead of buying like three comics, you'd spend a buck and get like four comics worth of comics. And what I liked is sometimes you'd get obscure characters that you wouldn't have in a monthly title, which I really liked. Well, this one has a great cover. It has a Batman melting in the background, Alfred panicking, and Superman's like, "You murdered the Batman. You can't be Bruce Wayne." And Bruce Wayne is saying, "I am Bruce Wayne, but who is that?" And it's by Garcia Lopez, which is a pretty awesome artist. And this story op is really good. I really liked all the stories in this book. The Superman Batman was the best, and it was the longest. I think it was almost like two stories worth. But it's a good detective story. Batman and Superman are trying to uncover why all these public figures in high political areas are acting very weird. Like, there's a scientist that has a cure for some disease, and he's like, "I ain't gonna release it unless you give me the money." And he's a humanitarian, you know, just doing like complete opposite of what you're used to with these people. And it's like an investigation, and it's happening worldwide. And they find this one character who's trying to kill he's actually a sniper, and he's like a well-known assassin. And they try to take him out and arrest him, and they do arrest him. His name is Esteban, and they arrest him, but they see Esteban in several other locations, and they're like, "What the fuck? I arrested this guy, and he's showing up several other places." Well, it turns out that the main villain of this book is a terrorist organization that's just like into anarchy, and you don't learn it until like the third arc. They're called the Dalsaidi, and it's a bunch of like Arabic guys that are all cloned. And what they do is they get the original person and they clone their body, and then are able to guide that person to do whatever they want and cause chaos amongst everybody. And they even try to do it to Clark, and they do it to Alfred, and they do it to Bruce. So they clone a lot of them and then keep them the real person imprisoned, and they have to defeat them. And it is a really cool story. The second story is Green Arrow and Black Canary, which is awesome. Like, I love these characters. And the thing I like about this is Black Canary has her plant shop or whatever, and she's looking to explore a different type of job skill in like fashion, women's fashion. And this particular area is attacked by a villain who we have seen before, Helgramite, who's that bug-looking villain. And he's like stealing kinds of wool and stuff that he's using, and you don't know why he's doing it, but she has a run-in with him, and Helgamite's able to put her in like some weird cocoon. And he's a smart villain, because one of the first thing he does is cover her mouth so she can't use her canary cry, and she could suffocate. But she's able to cut loose within the cocoon with her canary cry, and it eventually blows up all of that cocoon that she's in, and she escapes. She goes to talk to Ollie, and there's a lot of tension in this relationship at the time, because Ollie is on this, like, kick where he always had these, like, anger management problems, you know. He always went through phases. He was always fighting with Hal. Because he had these agendas that he wanted to focus on helping people a lot, and the everyman. And Canary's saying, we have to go fight Helgamite. And he's like, no, I'd rather stay and help. We should be helping the people that are down there on the street that need help, not this stupid nonsense. And Black Canary runs out on him and says, I'm not your slave. And they have like a really big fight. And you find out what Helgamite is doing, and that it is kind of a cool concept that he would take these people, like these really the 1% people, like the real rich, all the people that Ollie hates the most, because Ollie's like, even though he was one of those 1%ers, he likes to fight for the everyman.
Yeah.
But he would take those people that had like controversy, like weren't paying their taxes or were in some kind of trouble. They'd give him money, and then he'd wrap them in this weird little cocoon and change their appearance, much like the Logan's Run electronic laser device, except he wraps them in a cocoon and they come out a whole different identity, and then that person's gone. And Black Canary uncovers this and actually takes out Helgamite. While Green Arrow is trying to help fight on the streets, and he gets captured by some of Helgamite's goons coincidentally. So he gets caught up in this storyline because they captured Black Canary, even though Black Canary looked like she was going to take him out. And there's this real rich guy that he goes in there and he asks Ollie for his help, and he tells him, I know who you are. I know you're the Batman. And he says, here's a costume for you. So it was interesting how he could think that Ollie was the Batman, but especially with that beard.
Yeah.
He had to do his pull on that. And then it had a vigilante story. Oh, I should tell you who the people are, because they're all big names. Or they're people that we've heard about. On the first story, the Superman Batman, it was Bob Haney and Kurt Schaffenberger. That was a really cool story. On the Black Canary one, it was Jerry Conway and Trevor Von Eden with Vince Coletta inks. And the next story is Vigilante, which is the Vigilante. Not the modern vigilante, but the cowboy with the motorcycle, the guns, and the bandana around his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
He's fighting one of the Golden Age characters called the Dummy, which looks a lot like the Penguin, but he's a lot smaller, and he looks like a dummy, like kind of like a Scarface, but not quite. And it talks about his sidekick, which is cool because I never realized that the Vigilante had a sidekick. His name was Stuff. I guess if I read, I get that cough.
Sorry.
I have to drink. It's harder to do when you're talking.
Yeah.
But this story ended that arc, and they took out the Dummy. And it says the next story will be the Creeper. And then it has an awesome I got that itch, so I got to finish up quickly. It's got a team up with Sergeant Rock in World War II with Wonder Woman. Because in this time period, Wonder Woman is actually in the World War II area, which is really cool. And it's by Jerry Conway with art by Mike Volsberg and Dick Giordano. This story was really, really cool. It was such a cool team up to see, like, Sergeant Rock teaming up with Wonder Woman. And they were fighting, God, what that guy, the guy's name? I can't even think of his name now. He's one of Wonder Woman, Dr. Psycho. And they drew him like weird because the Dr. Psycho that I know is kind of like a small person, like really small. Maybe like 3 feet, if that, maybe 3'5". And he's a mind controlling guy, and now he looks like about 5 feet, maybe, with a big head, and he's working with the Nazis, and an alien race to try to take out America. And Wonder Woman and Sergeant Rock are there to foil him, and it is such a cool story. And it's one of those issues that has like two cliffhangers, like the Wonder Woman story and the Green Arrow story have like these cliffhangers that you actually want that next issue. And
Nice.
I think this might be my next what do you call it? The ADD switch, where I go to buy all these dollar comics now, you know, that have the multiple stories. But I can't tell you how much fun I had. And the other
They're
thing I liked
cool.
about it is this 80-page giant took me almost like 45 minutes to read. You know, you don't get comics like that now. It
Right.
was dense. It had a lot of story. Really enjoyable. Like, I'm sure that Dracula book took you a little bit more than like a modern comic.
Yeah. But yeah, I would like to at some point pick up some more like Batman and Superman family books, 'cause they're just I had like a I read like I read a Superman family book a while back. It's just fun because you get all these different characters, but they all relate to each other in some way. And it just gives you a nice, varied read, you know? Get to try a
Yeah,
bunch of different characters.
it's been a while since I've read. Wonder Woman's had all these incarnations, and there was one incarnation where they put her back into World War II. It might have been that time frame where her TV show was on, because I believe in that era they were fighting Nazis in certain areas, or maybe it was a modern day Nazi or whatever. But it was so
Yeah, because
cool to see Sergeant Rock there. Working with Wonder Woman, you know?
I talked about
But
that issue a few episodes back, I think it was, where I read that one random Wonder Woman
Wonder
issue
Woman
that I
comic,
had.
yeah.
That was when it was back in the 50s for a stretch.
Yeah,
Yeah, it's cool.
it's really cool to see her in that era. It kind of goes back to Brian's question. taking a character out of her original era and putting her into like this World War II context, and here it really worked. It really did.
definitely.
And
Yeah, being a one and
it
one.
worked more so because of the, I guess, the wartime situation, you know. She's actually in her invisible plane taking out bombers and shit, you know. It's really cool.
Yeah, that would be a case where I wouldn't want her permanently there, but to have stories set in that time period is really fun. For sure. Well, speaking of going back to things, I talked about I got that Humble Bundle, the Valiant Humble Bundle, and I still have a lot of stuff from that. Well, some of it I had already read, and I just would thought it'd be cool to have like a digital copy, and then but it had a bunch of the Valiant Masters in it, and I talked about a few issues of Exo Manowar a little while back, and so I thought of those, and I decided to read an issue out of the Hardcore Valiant Master, and I didn't know this going in, but it was interesting to discover that this collection starts off with two issues of Harbinger, because I don't know a lot about original Valiant, besides like what properties were involved and stuff like that. I don't have a collection or anything, so and I didn't really read them back in the day. But yeah, it actually starts with Harbinger issues 10 and 11, and then it has the first six issues of the Hardcore series. And I was also pleasant. I was pleasantly surprised to find that this issue that I read and the next one, Harbinger 10, was actually written and penciled by David Laffam. And I mean, I did know that he was involved with Valiant, and I like his writing, but I also really like his penciling too, which he doesn't do as much as. I like his art. So
He
there's
has
a little.
been doing some pencils in like DC's, but they're just like fill-in issues lately, like in the New 52.
Yeah, I did get that issue of he wrote or he drew an issue or two of Dial H. That was good. I still like his stuff.
He's doing a lot of other ones too. I
Cool.
don't know if he's like a go-to guy if somebody's in trouble or do that one-shot fill-in or what, but he's been doing a lot. So he's not only a talented writer, he's usually known to me as a writer that an extreme writer. Like he does some crazy titles and violent, but he also does kids stuff too, for like Dark Horse. He's diverse.
Definitely. So I'm more familiar with I almost said New 52, but the modern Valiant universe and that Harbinger. But it does give me some touchstones to kind of get what's going on here too, because there are similarities. But even with that, I mean, it does kind of throw you in a little bit. But this is the first appearance of the Hardcores. So it's cool that they included it. Even though the issue is more of a Harbinger issue. So I had to kind of hit the ground running a little bit, but it's called New Beginnings. Besides David Laffam, it was inked by a guy named Gonzalo Mayo. The Harbinger kids, they are returning to the home of a doctor named Lawrence Hayward and his family, just kind of suddenly appearing in their house. And if this is obviously occurring after a bunch of stuff has happened in the first nine issues of the series, and as they get there, the Chris with a K, female Chris, not me. She's not feeling well, and it turns out that she's been pregnant, and it's like, what's going on with this? And you could tell that the Harbinger kids have some sort of prior relationship with this doctor and his family. They're familiar with each other. But by like the third or fourth page, you get these panels every once in a while where you can tell that they're under surveillance, that these individuals, you don't get really a good look at them, but there's people in the field and people back at some kind of area where there's a bunch of computer screens and stuff, and they're monitoring the Harbingers, such that when Flamingo, who can heat things up, when she uses their power to warm her coffee up, they get an alert. So they're looking for displays of the Harbinger's powers. So they're kind of trying to get back on their feet, the Harbingers, and Peter and Chris, they go to try to rent an apartment, and they end up talking the guy down to it's like $600 a month and including utilities. So they rent this apartment. It's actually for the four of them that are traveling together: Chris, Zephyr, Flamingo, and Peter. So then later on, they have this interesting c conversation that kind of ties into like the overall Valiant universe, where Peter and Chris are talking about the fact that she was really pregnant, and Peter's asking her what happened to the baby. She says, you know, this is going to sound insane, but my baby was Magnus, meaning like the robot fighter. And she says, I know it's hard to believe, but it's true. And Solar, Man of the Atom, took him to the future. And she's starting to just like get a little hysterical. And he's like, it's okay.
I forgot about that.
I mean, I know who those characters are, but I don't really know like
what
all that's about. But it's just kind of like a sign of, you know, the Valiant universe at this time was very tightly connected. So
yeah,
you see that there. So Peter, he goes to get a job at this place called Biotech. He's only 18, but he's like got really good credentials, and he gets assigned to be a lab assistant to a guy named Samuel Lowenstein. And so they're back at the apartment later on, and he's telling the others about getting the job, and they're all trying to get jobs to contribute. Chris has got some interviews lined up, and Zephyr's got an interview at a comic book shop because she's like still like the real geek. She's wearing an ElfQuest t-shirt. And Flamingo's talking about how she actually kind of wants to take a shot at the modeling career that everyone always told her she should do because she's so pretty. So then there's kind of like an interesting sequence where like they go back to the city and to try to find Eighth Day Inc., which is where Harada was. And they go there and like the night security guy doesn't know what the hell they're talking about, this Eighth Day Inc., and nothing's listed on the registry, and they go up to the 47th floor where Eighth Day was, and it's all cleaned out, everyone's gone. And so they leave, and they're just like really frustrated that they've lost track of Harada. And you know, they talk about how, well, maybe we should try to track down more people like that have powers. So Zephyr's like, well, let's go check out some arcades. So before they go in, it's kind of funny because Peter's like, let's not be conspicuous. Like, let's, you know, be careful here. And as soon as they walk in, Zephyr says, excuse me, anybody here got any superpowers? But it ends up working out. It's a little dicey for a minute, but then they're clued into this, this woman named Shakita, who doesn't have like outright powers and stuff, but she's just like killing people on this video game. Like, I don't know if it's a fighting game, like maybe they're playing Street Fighter 2 or something. But she's just like, she's hustling people basically, like to the point that people start to get pissed at her, and her boyfriend's like, Daryl, it's like, we better get out of here. Where she's just talking trash. So the Harbingers, they follow her. At first, Daryl and Shakita are really suspicious of them. They think maybe that they're from the arcade and trying to get their money back and stuff. And they almost get in a fight. Things calm down, and they try to fill in Daryl and Shakita about what's going on. She's like, I don't. It's like, well, we think that you might actually, think you might have like hyper reflexes. It might, so Hardcore, they've continued to be monitoring the situation. There's one of them, this guy named this Maniac, and he's getting frustrated. He's like, I'm a soldier. Like, I'm not gonna like, I wasn't in Nam for 4 years to sit around on a rooftop, watch a bunch of punk kids. I'm done with this shit. And he's like, I'm bringing him in. And he takes off, and they're like, wait, dude, don't go. So he confronts them, and Peter immediately assumes that they're sent by Harada. So he attacks, he's aggressive right away. Even when the other members of the Hardcore show up, try to tell him, you know, we're just here to talk. We're not going to hurt you. Peter's not having any of it and starts shooting like energy blasts at them and shit. And the other Harbingers follow suit. Even Chris, she like pretends to, she doesn't have powers, but she pretends to be scared, like, don't hurt me. And then when the guy gets close, she like palms him across the jaw. So basically, I mean, it just kind of ends where they are able to escape from Hardcore, and they're up on the rooftop of this building at the end of the thing, and they're talking some more to Daryl and Chiquita, and Peter's sort of, you know, continuing to talk to her about the fact that he thinks she has powers, and she's like, "Well, what about those guys that just attacked us?" He says in the last panel, "Don't worry about them. They're not going to mess with me anytime soon." But we see it. We see the panel through the sights of a like a high-powered technological rifle sort of thing, letting you know that he's not quite right about that. And the next issue, which I didn't read yet, number 11 of Harbinger, it's captured by Hardcore, and it shows Peter lying down, strapped into this like machine, where and the members of Hardcore are standing there looking at him. So. Yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, I
So
like
was that 10 and 11 or just
that
10?
was just 10, and then I just was just describing what the
The
cover of
11.
11 looks like. Yeah, and then the rest of the book is Hardcore issues 1 through 6, but
I have that
which
Master Series and I guess I didn't open it thinking they would have put the Harbinger issues in there.
yeah, I mean, it's the issues, it looks like maybe 11 is has more of Hardcore, but so I mean, it was a little bit heavy on Harbinger, which I didn't care or anything. I enjoyed it, and like I said, I like the creator, and I was happy to see David Laffam art, which he also does issue 11. Then it looks like he does only the art on Hardcore issue 1, whereas like David Michelinie takes over the writing, and then there's a different artist after that. But yeah, it's cool. I mean, I continue to be impressed with what little like I have read, but when I do pick up OG Valiant stuff, it's good. It holds up. It's good writing. It's good stuff.
Yeah, it's a company that I think is, even though some of it might be timed, like sometimes in Shadow Man and stuff, you'll actually see dates. They were very date oriented. You at least know what all of this what the timeline is, because like Shadow Man was gonna die at a certain date, so you kind of knew as the time was clicking. Just like in Spawn, you'd always see the date, you know, the timer in Spawn. All right,
Yeah,
so
it was tight continuity, but that was one of
yeah,
the things like people that were
that's a
really into
positive.
it.
I don't understand why Valiant doesn't catch on more, you know? It perplexes me because the stories are so good. The new Valiant, I don't understand why it sells as low as it does. I'm so biased with it. Like I'm so vested in it, so I can't, I guess, look at it from a different angle. But
No, you're right. I mean,
I
I.
like the tight continuity. I like that one book ties into another book, and I like that in comics as well, so.
Yeah. And I actually think Valiant, actually they do a good job though of making it accessible to new readers. Their summaries that they have are like you can really pick up an issue, and if you're willing to just to read the summary, it'll tell you what you need to know to enjoy the issue. 'Cause I mean, I fell behind, and I stopped getting Valiant for a while. But I'm actually planning like with the Valiant next titles that are coming out, like I'm planning to jump back on and start getting it getting Valiant again. 'Cause I mean, they have really great creators. Like the writers that they have right now are some of my favorites, so I want to
Yeah.
support it. So.
All right, so my next one is, which I've covered in the past already. This I'm revisiting something as well. Well, you're revisiting a bundle. I'm revisiting Legends of the DC Universe number 5, and I cover number 4. I think about a couple months ago. This is by William Messner-Loebs and Mike Diodato Jr. doing pencils. It's a second part to a story arc that dealt with an officer, Martzen, and she was in a bank with Julia and Wonder Woman, and she was kind of fighting a bunch of mech women. And Wonder Woman was trying to defuse the situation, and the officer was just going gun happy, and bullets are flying everywhere. And it kind of showed how she was kind of losing her marbles. But she's getting interviewed by a police psychologist, and she's being very rude and coarse back to him. And she believes that the armor that these villains had should have been issued to the policemen and not stolen. These were like armors that were supposed to go to the policemen, but they pulled them back and locked them up because they had some defects in them. And it looks like someone broke in, stole the armor, and then released it to this gang of females. And Martzen's really busy, bitter about that. So Wonder Woman goes to question one of the females that, they're called the Red Blacks, in the hospital that was put in the hospital in the bank situation in the last issue. And she doesn't get too much information other than she kind of knows who to question after that. Someone breaks into the armory and steals the armor for the one that they did capture from the Red Blacks, and it's Martzen, the female detective. And she steals the armor to go. She's very vengeful. She's going to find the other Red Blacks and take them down. And she has a run-in with Wonder Woman, manages to knock Wonder Woman out, and then heads to the location of one of the gang members, which happens to be a house filled with many kids and an older woman. And she gets into a situation where she almost crushes one kid and she knocks out the older woman. She makes the situation worse. And Diana gets there in time and is able to save the woman. And you find out that the villain behind all of this, or that's kind of guiding this, is Ares. And then there's just a bunch of there's a fight scene between the Red Blacks and Martzen. And it doesn't bode well, but the armor just happens to the defect manifests itself while the detective's in it and kind of blows itself up. And one of the Red Blacks actually says, you know, like she thinks with her conscience, says, I need to save her, as she falls to the ground and is eventually going to be killed. She saves Martzen, and Martzen is still bitter when they release her back on the street. But they do that thing where they get her to confess without her knowing what she's doing. But it turns out that she gave these pieces of armor to these gang members because she knew they weren't going to issue them to the police because of the defects, and wanted to use the armor to fight villains. And that's what the whole plot was. And it looks like it was driven by Ares, but they arrest that detective, and that story ends. And Ares is like, "Damn it, I was defeated again." But yeah, it was a cool little two-parter. The art was good. The interesting thing about Wonder Woman's look in this is she does have it's like a mini skirt, except it's not tight, it's loose. It looks like a small dress. So that's kind of interesting in her look in this time period. And this was from 1998, cover price of $1.95. So we went from a dollar comic in the 70s to one that was $1.95 in the 90s.
Nice. Well, yeah, I'm not straying too far here because I ended up with a run of this would be my last thing. I ran into a run of Detective Comics for cheap, a small run. And at the beginning of it was a two-part story in issues 580 and 581. A Two-Face story by written by Mike W. Barr. Different artists, the first, or no, actually, I think it's just the maybe the well, the artist on the first one is Jim Baikie, Baikie. And on the second one, he's the artist, but also Pablo Marcos as well. So the first issue is called Double Image, and we see a Two-Face waking up with bandages on his face, looking in the mirror, thinking that it was all a dream, but one side of his face is, you know, as scarred as is the case with Two-Face, and he goes to the closet and he finds the clothes that the suit with the half orange, half black, or half orange, half purple suit and everything like that, finds the coin, and he flips it and it comes up with the crossed out heads. So he says, you know, the coin spoken, Two-Face lives again. So then we see a party at this with all these rich people and stuff that Two-Face arrives and busts it up with his gang to rob him, and Batman and Robin show up. This being the Jason Todd Batman, or yeah, Jason Todd Robin.
Well, I didn't know Jason Todd was Batman at
I
any
know that would
time.
be
Is this a new
interesting, huh?
continuity?
This is a secret. This is actually an
An
early release of a
Elseworlds?
convergence. just try to slip in here. I'm not even supposed to have. No. So yeah, Jason Todd Robin.
You're breaking the
Robin.
10-year rule. I just have you know.
Yeah. breaking all kinds of rules, breaking the law, breaking the law. So, Jason, as he did, rushing in because Two-Face is the one that killed his parents, right? Or no, his father. Yeah, Two-Face is the one that killed his Jason Todd's father. So he rushes in, without planning, gets knocked out and gets taken hostage by Two-Face, which allows Two-Face to escape, and he leaves Robin behind. But Batman is pissed, and Jason tries to apologize and says, "I wasn't thinking," and Batman says, "Exactly, you weren't thinking just now or up there." And he's, you know, telling him, "You got to try to handle this anger that you feel. I understand it, but you got to channel it." So Batman goes to confer with James, or yeah, with James Gordon, and they're trying to get some the lowdown on Two-Face and what's going on with this whole situation, and so eventually they track down Two-Face, and once again, Robin almost like gets himself killed, gets in trouble. He's used to able to use some of his able to get out of the situation, but he's almost thrown into vatic chemicals by a couple of Two-Face's thugs, and so then they realize, though, after like this the second action sequence, that when they were looking at a photo earlier of Batman and Robin, the Tim Drake, or not Tim, the Dick Grayson Robin that was that Jim Gordon had in a battle, an earlier battle with Two-Face, that the Two-Face was holding his gun with his right hand, and Batman picks up on the fact that the Two-Face that they were just fighting was using his left hand. And so what it turns out to be is that the Two-Face that they are fighting is Paul Sloan. And this was this two issue storyline was where they kind of brought the Paul Sloan Two-Face into post-crisis. But he was a character that was introduced in the 60s, I think, where and his origin is recounted here, and it's pretty similar to, I guess, what it was before, where Paul Sloan, he was an actor that was cast in a movie about Two-Face, and he was cast because he looked pretty similar to Harvey Dent. And then when they were recreating the scene where Harvey Dent was scarred by acid, it was supposed to be a bottle of water, but somebody substituted acid, and history kind of repeated itself. It was one of the prop men on the set who was jealous of Sloane because his girlfriend had a crush on him, so he wanted to scar Sloane. But as a result, he ended up following Two-Face's criminal career and imitating Two-Face and being a second Two-Face. So once they figured out this, Batman and Robin go to see Paul Sloan's wife, and she's already kind of expecting the worst, and he's like, I'm afraid, yes, it's true. So they try to go after him. And the latest plot that Two-Face has got going on. And but unexpectedly, Harvey Dent shows up as well. Harvey had actually re-disfigured Paul Sloan. Like, he had been recuperated from the whole incident. He had had plastic surgery and had recovered. And Harvey Dent went after Paul Sloan and disfigured him again. And undid his plastic surgery so that that it would be a confusion tactic and a distraction to Batman, that having a second Two-Face out there would just make everything all the more confusing. So Paul, at this point, is pretty much convinced that he's the real Two-Face, and they both believe, Paul's pretty deep into his psychoses and his confusion because of what the real Two-Face has done to him. But there's a twist in that Sloane gets the upper hand and actually traps Batman, Robin, and the real Two-Face in a refrigerator t truck with a bomb set off to go off, and that's how the first issue ends. And opens in 581. They're trying to figure out how they're going to get out of this situation, and they have to work together with the real Two-Face, while the Paul Sloan Two-Face is just waiting for the bomb to go off. Well, his henchmen are starting to whisper because they've seen everything that's gone on, and they didn't realize that they weren't following the real Two-Face, and they're starting to whisper, and Paul Sloan is getting upset about the whole situation. Well, the real Two-Face, he's not too much of a help. He's just kind of mocking Robin and trying to egg him on, based on the fact that he killed his father. But Batman, cool under pressure. No pun intended, but and Tim, or yeah, I'm getting all my Robins mixed up. And my Batman's. Jason, he's pretty much freaking out too, but Batman shows him you got to keep her cool. And he's like, those pipes up there, the reason it's cold in here, because those coils have Freon gas in there. And I'm going to rip one of those loose and I can give the bomb a concentrated Freon bath and stop it from exploding. So I thought that was actually a pretty cool solution. Like, it's actually believable. And then he uses a jagged end of one of the coils to cut the ropes that are holding them. But they need Harvey Dent's cooperation to get out of the situation that they're in. And so they kind of set up a situation where they're gonna trap Paul Sloan, the imposter, and create like create a trap where they're gonna put him in a situation that they're gonna bring out his wife to try to convince him to try to knock him out of this psychosis, and they're able to be successful with that. But then at this point they have to use Paul Sloan's help to track down the real Two-Face. So it's kind of interesting how it kind of flips backwards around, and Sloan's actually able to be the one to help go after Harvey Dent. There's like a sequence which is repeated on the cover where you have two Two-Faces fighting it out with each other. And Batman actually in the end flicks two coins at them, and one Two-Face catches it with the left hand and the other one catches it with the right hand, and so that's how Batman knows which one to punch in the face. And we see a little bit of growth on Jason's part where Batman offers him the opportunity to say something to Two-Face, and Jason says, I thought I hated him for what he did, but I don't. I just kind of pity him, and in a way that's worse. And this is the chum era of
Oh, so
Batman.
you
He
get
says,
the.
"I know, chum, I know."
That's such a weird thing.
Yeah, I think
I
it
never
might be a
noticed it
guitar
until
thing.
recently, with Daryl talking about
Yeah.
it.
So it ends with Sloane recovering
I
in
know
the
in the TV
hospital.
show they used to say it a lot,
Yeah.
but this is way off the TV show.
I know. But I think Mike W. Barr, he like picked up on that from the TV show and wanted to use it. But yeah, so it was kind of neat. Kind of a neat story. Like, such it's a weird like, I think in pre-crisis, Sloan was the Earth 2 Two-Face. Like, on Earth 2, Sloan was Two-Face, and then the original Harvey Dent Two-Face was healed. But then you have, like, here in post-crisis, you have the two of them the kind of using that concept in a new way. And then I guess later there's a Paul Sloan that after 0 Hour comes out as a person named the Charlatan. But so yeah, that's kind of a neat, and it's kind of neat, like the whole thing of Two-Face and the doubles and stuff, and to have two Two-Faces is kind of an interesting take on, or an interesting take on the theme.
Yeah, that's those are cool covers too.
So that's it for me.
All right, well, I got two more, but I'll be really fast. One of them is the Spectre. This is his second series. So the Spectre originally appeared in More Fun Comics number 52, and then became a All-Star a Justice Society member. In All-Star Comics, and then reappeared in the Silver Age in Showcase number 60, which led to his own title, which was the first series, but didn't last long. In the first series, I believe was the debut of one of Neil Adams' issues on number two. But this is the 1987 series, and it goes in. I think we talked about Young All-Stars and some of those, but in the Young All-Stars and some of those other titles, you would see at the corner of the comic book the new format. These weren't the specialized paper, but they were like this new format comic book. I think the paper was different, but it wasn't that glossy paper. So this was an interesting book to choose because it's part six of six, but it was one that I was missing, so it was in the box of books that I hadn't read. So I picked it up and read it. It is by Doug Monick. I can never Munch. Doug Munch, and Tom Artist is on art with inks by Tim Gula. It's a very scratchy looking art style, but it's effective and it tells the story well. But there's this villain called Reddick, and he seems to be able to wanting to start a war with Russia as far as nuclear devices go. So he takes over this weird body, and he becomes a ghost in the machine that Spectre has to go after. And his goal is to either have the US launch the bombs first at Russia, or to have Russia launch the bombs because of the risk that the US is posing on them. So it is a very intense, action-paced issue of whether they're going to launch the nukes or not. And the Spectre does manage to stop Reddick, and he tries to transfer to other bodies, and the only body that he goes to is his own corpse, but Spectre beats him there. And it's weird because he's like, because this is part six, I don't know how it all happened or remember how it happened, but he had like 10,000 people in comas, and Reddick was able to actually siphon their energies to empower him to fight the Spectre, which was kind of unusual. But at the end of the issue, they all come out of their comas and they actually save the day. But it was a really good issue as far as pacing, and they did a really good job of making it like on the seat of your pants, like, is this going to start a war? Kind of. There were several times where you thought all-out war was going to start, and they did a good job of showing that threat. So that was a pretty good issue. This issue, I think, was the longest running Spectre series. It ran 31 issues and had an annual, and involved a lot with Madame Xanadu. The third series, which is the John Ostrander series, which is probably my favorite. Oh no, that ran 62 issues in one annual, so that one had even a longer run. And then the fourth series was the Hal Jordan as the Spectre. Instead of being the spirit of he was the spirit of redemption. That one ran 27 issues, and so we have four series of the Spectre, and they've had fairly decent runs. We haven't Maybe that will be one of the new DC 52s if they can tap Clarion. They have introduced the Spectre in the new 52 and toyed with him in Justice League Dark, Constantine, and the other books. So maybe we'll see him in a fourth series for at least 12 issues coming up.
Yeah, that'd be cool. It's such a cool concept. I mean, I haven't read a ton of the Spectre stuff, but I'd like to read some more eventually. Like, I would definitely try a Spectre series. That's Paul or Constantine. I mean, not what the hell am I saying? Whatchamacallit, the first Spectre. Very cool.
Corrigan?
Yeah, Corrigan.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think
Well, I think he's
Gotham
gonna
by Midnight
Gotham
is
by
gonna be
Midnight is gonna be that Spectre book. Yeah. And that
I'm
one
gonna
just
check
came
that
out,
out.
so
Yeah, I gotta read the first
And
issue.
he
I
is
think I just
still
got it.
showing up in the Batman Eternal, so you will get the Spectre if you look for him.
True.
So the next book is just a continuation of a book I've been covering a lot on this podcast, and it's John Sable Freelance. I'm up to number 5, which is the origin story. And in previous episodes, he was kind of losing his mind, going after the guy in the white hat, and he became very vengeful for him killing his wife and 2 kids. And he's become a drunk. And Michael, who's his artist, is reading his kind of his diary. I guess he published it, but I hope he didn't publish it to the public. It's like it's called A Storm Over Eden by John Sable, and it's kind of got staples on it. So I don't think he's published it, but she found it and was reading it. So we're learning his origin through her eyes. And what's interesting now is he's in prison, and one of his old buddies, Milo Jackson, comes to talk to him, and he goes, "I'm a mercenary, and I can get you out of the prison. I can post your bail, but I need you to help me rescue this rich kid who was in a hot air balloon that got knocked down. They're in Africa, and his father is offering us a lot of money to retrieve him right now. And I need you to come back." And he's like, "No." Like, at this time, he's kind of like drowning in his. He's in the phase where he's so depressed, he just wants to die. And the only way he eggs him on is he's like, "You'll get money, you'll get this." And he's like, "What do I need money? I have nothing to live for anyway." And he's like, "Well, there's a high probability you could die on this mission." So he kind of did a dead shot and goes with this guy on this mission. And there's a lot of other guerrilla fighters that they have to fight. And the first thing they do is they get into these jeeps to go to try to find this kid and his party, who are basically cornered in one part of this area in Africa, and being gunned down by the guerrilla fighters. And they have to go get to them. Well, they get into these jeeps to drive out there, and one of these things is an old fighter plane, comes after them and shoots up their jeeps. But John Sable's pretty badass. He basically is able to. It's a Spitfire Tiger plane. He's able to shoot underneath the plane because he knows that the underbelly is the weakness of the Spitfire, and he takes out that guy. But they lose another mercenary, and every time they lose a mercenary, they're all like, "Oh, we could divide the reward into 6. Now it's 5, and now it's 4." So the reward, the monetary reward gets larger as they go on. Well, they actually get there, and they fight off a lot of the guerrilla fighters. But they're like, "Okay, now that we have the kid and the people that were in the hot air balloon, how do we get him out of here?" And they come up with this weird. They employ this weird device where they have to light a fire to try to keep the guerrilla fighters away from them, and use the hot air balloon to escape without the gondola, kind of like hanging from the balloon, each one of the members. They left a couple of the members behind, but put the kid on there, a woman that was with them, and a couple of the mercenaries went with them. One of the things that was really interesting is there seems to be a lot of I don't know how he's trying to deal with this racism stuff, but most of these mercenaries were white, and there's one black mercenary. And each one of these mercenaries is captain, except the black guy. He's a sergeant. And Sable actually points that out. And later on, when they're escaping, they manage to get away. Well, the woman is carrying a bag, and he's like, "We have to drop our weapons, drop everything that weighs us down so we can get away." The woman won't drop her bag. And she says, "We need to let some weight go." So she actually pulls a gun out of her bag and wants to shoot the black guy and calls him a Kaffir. I guess she's from South Africa or something like that. And she doesn't want to let her bag go, and you're like, why does she not want to let her bag go? Well, it's probably filled with like cocaine or heroin. They don't really say what kind of drug it is. But Sable pulls the gun to protect the other mercenary, And actually, she falls to her death. So she dies, but they manage to get away. And there's only a few of the guys left. And that's how that story arc ends. And I don't know if they're going to continue with the origin story in the next issue, but they may just keep built. Yeah, it is. It's the next issue is the conclusion of the origin story. So we'll see how that ends in
That's
probably the
cool.
next episode so I could wrap up the origin. But
It's
this woman here, there's a couple weird things in here. She points the gun at, she won't drop her bag when she's instructed to drop her bag. And then she says, "No, I think we ought to drop the Kaffir." And then she pulls the gun on him. And then she said, "Bigger shares all around." And that's when Sable, even though all these mercenaries dropped their guns because it was weighing them down on the balloon, except for her, he kicks her. He swings over and kicks her and then throws, like, cuts her rope, and she like is hanging there, and he lets her fall to her death. And as she falls to her death into the fire that they lit to keep the guerrilla fighters away, the bag rips, and there was like cocaine in there. So she was trying to like smuggle in drugs or smuggle out drugs so she could make money. But they did end up rescuing the kid that they set out to rescue, so he probably will have his share of reward. But the only reason he went on this mission is because he wanted to have the risk of being killed, I guess.
That's a very different, interesting series.
Yeah, it is. The art is awesome. He makes a good, re a weird remark too to the woman, like it's almost like a sexist remark earlier. Because she is sexy. And early on, he's like, what does he say? Oh, she says her name is Cynthia, and my friends call me Sin. And he goes, "Oh, I bet." So, yeah, it's a cool book. And the art is amazing. I like my girl a lot.
Yeah, it's good. Another good person that does a creator that can do both.
Yeah. The only thing that's depressing me is I'm seeing a bunch of issues I'm missing here. Son of a bitch.
I think you can get them all really cheap though. Like the whole
Oh,
run, I
not of
think, is pretty
Sable,
much.
but of the Spectre.
Oh, okay.
I thought I had most of them, and there are some that I am missing. It's either that or I bought them, and I had a bad habit, like for 10 years, of not putting them in the database until I read them. But now when I buy back issues, they immediately go into the database even before I read them, which means I have to search some boxes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That actually, yeah, I kind of wondered. I know that sometimes you're always talking about how you're updating your database, but then occasionally you'll mention that you're not sure if you have something, so that clears up where that is.
Yeah, it's. I really should go through this one closet that has that situation that I know I have, and just put them into the database regardless of whether I've read them or not. But that's a lot of work, and it needs a lot of time, and I don't have that time. That's where I was hiring you to come out here and do that.
Still interested in that possibility. So,
Well, that wraps up our books.
right. Yeah, I think we can wrap up.
Yes. So, we are located at geekbrunchpodcast.com. We are on iTunes, and you can search for Geek Brunch Podcast and leave an iTunes review. That would make us really happy. That review site is for both podcasts, so if this is specific for retro, you have to say, "Hey, it's for retro." At
Facebook.
Facebook is Geek Brunch Podcast. You could click the like button and follow all the threads there. We post our episode threads there as well. And also some miscellaneous stuff. Emails, mythmakingetc@gmail.com, right?
Yep.
And mike@comicbooknoise.com. Those are our emails. So you can send us emails at any time, and we'll cover them on on the podcast if it's a question or a comment or anything. And you can send us Twitters at MythMakingETC or at Mike Myers Brunch at any time, and we'll discuss them on the podcast as well. So next time we have a potential to cover Taxi Driver. And comic-wise, who knows what we'll cover, other than I might do the last issue of the Sable origin.
Yeah, it's always a mystery.
Yeah.
Even to ourselves.
Yeah, I didn't expect to cover like the Spectre this time. And I was hesitant, too, because I was going to cover like part 6 of a story, and I've only read those a long time ago, and I knew I wouldn't remember. But much to our benefit, the older the comic is, I think the better they were at setting up the situation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, they had the mentality of everybody's comic is their could be their first one.
Right.
So they're pretty good about setting the situation if you're jumping in the middle of a story. That you won't be lost. You try to do that with a modern comic, and it's rough.
Yeah, I mean, it's the way that things have changed and how you buy them and stuff. Most of the time, people aren't picking them up off the newsstand or at the gas station or anything like that, you know. So
Marvel does a good job. I wish DC would do it too. Marvel, you pick up a comic, and yeah, it might be harder to fit into the story. At least the first page sets you the situation up with the character and then tries to let you know where they left off last. Right. So you're not too lost. And I think Valiant does that too. I skipped that section usually. They didn't do it in Quantum and Woody too, but all the other issues they've done that on.
Yeah, and I found them helpful at times if I just, you know, after a month's gone by, just kind of refresh my memory so I can get into it real quick.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you have a good Sunday, and hopefully
thanks,
we'll
you
do
too.
One more of these before the holiday break.
Yeah, sounds good. Let's aim for it.
Yeah, even if we have to move it forward or move it forward a week. But let's try to get one more in before the end of the year.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you later, Chris. And you have a good Sunday and rest of the week.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
There is no sanctuary.